This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodling? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed. Mm-hmm.
Shallow some Bram? Skidamarinky-dinky-dink?
Yeah.
Skidamarinky-doo?
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pot. What's a mouthy, scraggly Canadian?
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I was just curious.
5 years. 5 years! We've been doing podcasts, and we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to another great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Rosero, coming to you live here on this Monday evening. And of course, joining me as always, my PIC, the one and only stuffed jive turkey that is Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Yeah, jive so bro, brother.
JR, welcome back, you and I, here on the Place to Be podcast. On this Thanksgiving weekend, it is episode number... 427 dash. Right. JR, always a pleasure, sir. Mm-hmm. Thanksgiving weekend is behind us, which means, JR, we're in our favorite season of the year.
We are.
Would you consider this your favorite month, minus your birthday?
But wouldn't the birthday be part of the favorite month?
Well, you love Christmas, so we don't. I mean, we've done this show now for almost 5 years, and we never really talked about
your birthday.
Yeah, why would
it be minus my birthday? All right, well, that's weird.
Well, I mean, do you love this
month outside of your birthday? Oh, okay.
Well, because
once you get to be your age, you hate your birthday? I don't know.
No, I've loved my birthday since, Toots bought me the gift card at the livery stable.
No, I don't think it's my favorite month. I do enjoy the Christmas season due to the music and the festivities, mm-hmm. and I do enjoy our Christmas episode every year. So no, it's one of my favorite seasons. I can't say it's my favorite month. I think October is my favorite month.
Oh, okay. Well, guess what? We're moving your birthday. No, I always look forward to this time of the year. And did you have a nice Thanksgiving weekend for the first time? In 5 years, 4 years, I did not join you this weekend, but yeah. You look like you had a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was probably the best I've had in 4 years. No, I'm not kidding. It was.
That was a T-ball I set you up right there.
It was good. It was very good as always. Had a nice Thanksgiving dinner. We had a fun day after Thanksgiving party, played some football, got our Christmas tree set up, so we had a lot going on. It was good.
Excellent. Good. The reason I did not... join the DAT this year was actually, and I cannot wait to tee this softball to you. My high school reunion was Friday night, and I saw a lot of guys I hadn't seen in a long time, and pretty much since June 2nd, 1991, when I walked the aisle with them, and some I didn't think would walk the aisle. But
did someone recreate William McKinley's speech when he spoke at your graduation?
That's exactly right. And then we had a nice, animals on spits, and, you know, we had musket shooting, and it was a fantastic, we had the wives in the stockade. It was great, but no, it was a good
stockade?
time. Stockade. And no, it was a wonderful time. Got to see a lot of people, guys I hadn't seen in a while. And then sadly, I had to go to a wake on Saturday, so kind of. But I actually saw people then that I hadn't seen in a while either. So it was a weekend to kind of get together with some and kind of reconnect with some people I hadn't seen in a while. So,
and if it's up to them, it'll be another long while, I'm sure.
They enjoy the musket shooting. Well, no one wants to get together for a wake. I mean, really, but.
Yeah. Liz Armento, and you just love planning them.
He stalks them, so he does like a tour, like, you know. Right. He's like Jake the Snake and the Cobras, you know. All right. JR, this evening is very special in the life of the Place to Be podcast because, as everyone knows, you and I put on separately, Backlash 2007, and I seriously wanted to stick a pencil in my eye. I mean, it's just...
Well, it's not that it's a bad show.
No, but it just made us realize that we're about to get to a stretch where... We're almost getting too close. I mean, I know it's 9 years, but...
It's not even that, because it's changed a lot. It was just uninspiring viewing to me. Like, I was losing interest in that timeline that we're on into 07. So, again, I mean, it wasn't bad. It wasn't, you know, it's not... I don't think it's too close, because, again, it's really different than today's product. But you were seeing more and more people come in that we see today that...
Yep.
You know, part of it, too, is that there's so much TV and so much pay-per-view over the last 10 years that a lot of the people on those cards were very overexposed. Yep. And the match quality is all fine, and this is stuff we talk about with today's product, but you just kind of run out of stuff to talk about. There's a lot of rematches, a lot of similar matches, like the prospect of watching three straight of the Vince McMahon, Umaga, Shane McMahon versus Lashley. Just as much as I love ECW Vince, like that was just like, ugh. You know, like there's so many rematches and just, it was just a period I wasn't super excited about. Now, I'm not saying we may never go back there. I mean, maybe we'll get tired
of this. We'll definitely go back sometime down the line. But, yeah, I mean, we were getting the prospects.
Along with Joe Dombrowski every month. But, I mean, I don't want to guarantee we make it back there. But we, you know.
I'm sorry. Do you have somewhere to go in the afterlife? I mean, I'm sure sometime in the next, decade. I was looking for kind of a wide window.
Maybe.
But who knows? But, I mean, things like, as much as we love John Cena and we love Randy Orton, I think the prospect of seeing, like, 25 pay-per-view matches over the span of like a year was going to be a little rough.
So it was that combined with the fact that when we were last in the era of 1985 to even to 90 during the 5-year stretch, we were in our infancy on this show. And you know, I'm not ashamed to sit here and say some of those weren't very good. You know, they have their moments, they have their laughs and a lot of organic laughs that were part of that. But we're still learning our way. There were a lot of times we talked about a match for 30 seconds, and we're like, oh, yeah, that match sucked, and we just moved on.
Just us as people. I mean, our equipment's better now. I mean, those episodes, some of them sounded bad.
Yeah, everything. I mean, we were just getting started. I mean, we did WrestleMania 1 was episode 3. You know, it was almost 6 years ago. So we've grown a lot, and we didn't put a lot of analysis into it. We didn't grade matches. We didn't rank or give awards a lot of time. We've evolved since then. So we thought it was a fitting time to go back and revisit those shows that are now almost 6 years old. So I don't feel funny in saying we just watched them. I mean, even at the time, I'm not sure how much we were actually watching the shows before we talked about them. So I think it's time to, you know, revisit those and add context to them, because you think we went from WrestleMania 1 to WrestleMania 2. Think of how much stuff we missed during that stretch, where now we're going to be filling them in because we're including the house shows from Madison Square Garden specifically. And we're going to do the Saturday Night's Main Event. So we've covered here and there on the podcast, but never in full, in order, looking at the match quality and whatnot. So we're going to fill a lot of the gaps that we didn't cover over that year-long stretch. We're going to see a lot of guys that never even made it to pay-per-view, half of them on the show tonight. Yeah. So I think it's a revisiting of the era, but it's a more in-depth, deep dive into the era as well. And we did get multiple questions asking why we didn't go back to 84 with Hogan's title win. And the brawl to end it all, or whatever it was, the original MTV special. Titans of Wrestling, who is also similar to this track of what we're going to be on, we're also are looking to go through 1984, from what we're told. So, their plan is to end once they get to 85, and that's where we wanted to pick up. So we're not you know, duplicating efforts. Right. And we've always been all about the pay-per-view era as well. So that's always kind of been our track. So that's why we picked 85 to start with. And we started in January because we wanted to include some of the bigger house shows leading up to WrestleMania. And again, it's fitting too because we're watching a lot of the stuff for the TNTs and the Network Adventure written series. So I'm getting to learn an era that I never had a lot of familiarity with.
Yeah, and I'm getting a chance to go back to an era
revisit
that I
your
watched
early 30s.
When I was at those house shows where, you know, Baron Mikhail Scicluna was a rookie.
Right.
Now, you know, that era of the mid 80s, you know, obviously was when I started watching and watching the garden shows on Channel 9, for those that live in the New York area and the tri-state area, you know, Channel 9. And, it's going to be fascinating, not just to talk about the matches and the guys and gals, but, the aesthetics, graphics, the garden itself. The garden itself went through a huge, transformation, which we'll talk about tonight. And I think that kind of stuff adds to the fun of it, adds to the entertainment value of it, where we're going to get into a lot of things we didn't talk about in 2011. Even guys like Gorilla, who we always consider the greatest play-by-play guy of all time, he had his missteps, and there were a few of them on this show, because he was growing and emerging as the voice of the Federation era. And so a lot of that kind of stuff that's just as integral to a show or to an era than the matches and the guys and gals themselves should definitely be taken seriously and discussed. So that's why we decided to go back to this moment. And we'll tell you what our show is tonight in a minute. But we took this spot because this is really the spot where the tide turned or the page was turned and officially the beginning of the modern pay-per-view era. And the Federation era began because, and you'll hear it on Titans, which is a fantastic show. Even 1984 was a little still very territorial looking, and we'll get into that. But I think turning the calendar to 1985 is a perfect spot for you and I to kick off and go back in time to an era that we really love a lot, and a lot of our listeners do as well. So it's good to go back in time. So.
And I do want to just give a little shout out so we don't forget as we move along. The kind of committee or crew that we've put together here as mm-hmm. we rebuilt this process out, they've all contributed greatly. So I do want to just call them out specifically. So, of course, we have our buddy Jeff Jarvis,
yes.
who helped put together a lot of the fun facts, put together some of the timeline that we're going to cover before we get started on the show. Our good friend Steven Sutton is back, mm-hmm. of course, in 1985 now with the Sutton facts and Sutton notes and championship roll call and whatnot. So mm-hmm. we'll be referencing him. Jason Greenhouse helping with some of the timeline, pop culture-wise, and other information. And Chad Campbell kind of helped us go back in time to revisit the older shows to talk about, come up with ideas of where we wanted to head with the different topics and whatnot. So give him a shout out. And of course, Steve Riddle, who's continuing his Vintage Vault previewing series with these shows. So you can check that out on the site earlier today. He did a match from the show as well. So that's kind of
yes,
the committee and the crew that's been working to help
yep.
us reset, reformat this. So I want to give a shout out to all of them right off the bat for helping us kind of get going. So why don't we dive in, Scott, before
okay.
we get too far in. I want to... So we're going to start with Jeff Jarvis's timeline that he puts together here. It's real brief. I just want to read through it.
Mm-hmm.
This is kind of the important timeline and notes that he thought we should cover off prior to 1985. So it's just like a real brief lesson in what we're building up to, and then we'll dive into tonight's show.
Okay.
So in 1979, prior to purchasing the company from his father, Vincent K. McMahon founded Titan Sports, Inc. and began applying trademarks to the WWF initials. This is the same year Vincent J. McMahon renamed the Worldwide Wrestling Federation to the WWF, dropping the wide. 1982, Vince Jr. purchased Capital Wrestling Corporation, which ran the WWF from his father, admitted in interviews later that if his father had known what plans were for the business, he would have never sold it to him. At the annual NWA meeting in 1983, Vince pulled out of the organization, began working to syndicate WWF programming nationally, angering promoters across the country. December of 83, Vince pulled Hulk Hogan back to the company. Hogan had originally wrestled under the WWF under Vince Sr. 1979 to 80, was fired when he took a role in the movie Rocky III against Sr.'s directive. During his earlier run, Hogan had been a heel under the management of Freddie Blassie. On December 26, 1983, in MSG, Bob Backlund, who had held the title for 4 years, lost the title to Iron Sheik. 2 days prior to the match, Sheik had kayfabe injured Backlund after jumping in from behind. During their match, Sheik had Backlund in the Campbell clutch to prevent further injury to his neck. His manager, Arnold Scotland, threw in the towel, ending the match and Backlund's title reign. January 7th, 84, Hogan saved Bob Backlund from a 3-on-1 attack from the Wild Samoan, cementing him as a face in his return. The beginning of 84 saw the debut of Roddy Piper in the WWF. Prior to this, Piper had been with Jim Crockett Promotions in the Carolinas. On his way out, had a brutal dog collar match with Greg Valentine at Starrcade. Injuries from that match prevented Piper from debuting as a wrestler in the WWF. It was a manager and hosted Piper's Pit. January 23rd, 84, we all know that is where Hulk Hogan, of course, defeated the Iron Sheik to win the WWF heavyweight title at Madison Square Garden. Backstage stories that Backlund only dropped the title to someone with a legitimate background, which is why he lost to the Sheik instead of directly to Hogan. 1984 was the birth of the Rock and Wrestling Connection. After meeting Cyndi Lauper in Puerto Rico, Captain Lou Albano had the idea of a cross-promotion with wrestling and music. Lauper asked Albano to play the role in her video of Girls Just Want to Have Fun. And during the spring of 84, McMahon brought Lauper into a role with Albano and Piper's Pit, where Albano turned heel on Lauper, saying that women should be in the kitchen pregnant and calling Lauper a broad. Lauper attacked Albano with her purse. Following the confrontation, Cyndi issued a challenge to Albano to show that he knew nothing about music and even less about wrestling. Each would choose a female wrestler, and the two women would compete with each other while Lauper and Albano served as managers. This led to the brawl to end it all from MSG. Well, Lauper's choice, Wendy Richter, would take on the Fabulous Moolah, which would be for the women's title. Moolah was billed for having the title for 28 years, even though she lost it several times in the mid-50s, as Scott can document, to the mid-70s. The event was broadcast on MTV, the first live wrestling event on cable, as well as the first live women's match in wrestling history on TV. The interference of Lauper during the match, Richter won the title and the belt from Moolah. Not all is perfect in 1984. In an attempt to get more coverage on cable TV, Vince purchased Georgia Championship Wrestling to get that coveted 6:05 time slot on TBS. July 14th, 84, known as Black Saturday, WWF began running their own content. Ratings were a disaster. Fans who were used to Georgia Championship Wrestling live studio saw reruns of the USA Network syndicated shows. Vince would sell that time slot to Jim Crockett in March of 85. And, of course, after running the promotional show leading up to Inaugural Mania, used that money to help fund the show. And this time period would eventually set the stage for the feud between Vince McMahon and Ted Turner. So, kind of a historic timeline, Scott. Anything you feel that wasn't covered from a real, you know, heavy importance point of view?
Well, when we get into the show, I mean, we could talk about it now, about the building we're going to be at tonight, because that is a historic icon in itself. But I was going to get more into that when we got into the show itself. Really not much. I mean, obviously Vince Sr. passed away. They did a big show for him at the Garden. And we'll talk about probably as these shows in 1985 progress, a lot of, Vince Sr.'s personal favorites. You'll see their names, you'll see their faces and hear their names, whether they're still wrestling or retired. Vince Jr. made a promise to his dad that he would keep 3 guys on the payroll when he bought Capital or when he bought the WWF. And those 3 guys were Pat Patterson, former Intercontinental Champion, first Intercontinental Champion, Gorilla Monsoon, and Arnie Skolin. And you'll see and hear those guys quite a bit over the next decade. But otherwise, no. I think you covered it very well. We'll get more into exposure on a national level in terms of television as the year progresses. But no, that's an excellent appetizer, a prologue, if you will, to where we are going to head right now. So we are ready.
All right.
The first show, the very first show of the year, 1985, that we will discuss, January 21st, 1985, live from the home office, and pretty much JR, what's going to kind of become our home office. We're kind of splitting cubicles with the Titans of Wrestling guys. Madison Square Garden in New York City. Now, for those that don't know, there have actually been 4 Madison Square Gardens. The first one was built on East 26th Street and Madison Avenue in 1879. Which is where my 25th reunion was. No. And it was there for 11 years. It actually, JR, was the site of the first, and this is kind of fitting for talking wrestling, the first Westminster Dog Show. was in this building. It was knocked down in 1890, and a new one was built on 26th Street and Madison Avenue, and that one closed in 1925. Boxing matches, orchestral performances, the circus, the 1924 Democratic National Convention. That lasted until 1925. And then the third Madison Square Garden was also built in 1925, but for the first time it left Madison Avenue and was built on 8th Avenue between 49th and 50th Streets on the side of the city's trolley car barns. It was the first garden that was not on Madison Square. It was the first home of the New York Rangers and the New York Knicks. So this was the building where they first started, because when this was built, the NHL and the NBA were created. It lasted until 1967, when the current Madison Square Garden opened, and that is where we are now. And it has been there since 1967, and that, of course, is where Vince McMahon Sr. had a lot of his, obviously started doing his big shows in the WWWF. Now, when we get into the first match, JR, and talk about the card itself, we'll get into more of the aesthetics. But Madison Square Garden, from what we remember from 1985 on, was very different looking before that date. It would look about the same in 1984, but 1985 is when it had the garden look that we would remember for the rest of our childhood. So we'll get to that in a minute. So we go now to January 21st, 1985. From Madison Square Garden, a crowd about 16,000. Some house shows, you'll notice through time that we do, will have huge crowds, because some nights, and I believe probably our next show will do this, they used to sell seats over at the Felt Forum, which was, you know, now it's the theater. But back then it was called the Felt Forum. So sometimes you'll hear us say a crowd of like 27,000, and you'll be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Well, they sold an extra 10,000 seats at the theater, and we'll put the show on a screen. They didn't do it on this show. This show was just the regular garden, and so it was about 16, 17,000 people. Your announcers are Gorilla Monsoon, and we'll talk about him, of course, as I just mentioned, and Mean Gene Okerlund, another steal by Vince Jr. from another promotion. Do we have a bio on him, JR, or should I just... chat about him briefly now?
Yeah, you can chat about him briefly.
Okay. Mean Gene, of course, as everyone knows, was a bastion of the AWA. He was the face of the AWA throughout the 70s and into the early 80s. But pretty much after the Hulk Hogan debacle at Super Sunday in May of 83, that is when the rumbling started that Vince was ready to blow up and start nationally. So unfortunately, Vern Gagne was the picking ground for all of the guys. And by early 1984, Hulk Hogan was gone. Jesse Ventura was gone. Bobby Heenan was gone. And that included Mr. Mean Gene Okerlund.
And
so,
Gene was interesting, too, because they use him in a pretty unique way. They don't just use him as, okay, here's a random announcer. They actually used him as a draw in Minnesota, as we've seen throughout some of the TNTs and other things we've watched. On the network or just other avenues. He was more than just, okay, we took this guy, he's a really good announcer. They actually used him in matches and angles in Minnesota. I mean, they made a big deal about when they had their first show in the Twin Cities, remember? And like Gene was like a big focal point of that. It was all over that one TNT. So he was a big part of the expansion they were planning beyond just being, okay, a competent voice and a trusted voice. He was actually a guy that they looked at as a draw.
Yeah, and remember the big storyline in 1984 – I guess the feud was between Hogan and Mean Gene against Mr. Fuji and George the Animal Steele, and they did vignettes where they're, you know, he's 5 o'clock in the morning and Mean Gene smoking a cigarette, drinking coffee, shoving like a coffee roll down his throat or something, and they're running around. He's grabbing a bratwurst at a stand in the park or whatever. Oh, it's so awesome. Great stuff. Great stuff. So like rudimentary, but for WWF it fit, you know. Mm-hmm. So anyway. Mean Gene is doing color commentary with Gorilla on this evening. Now, our first Sutton report of the decade of the 80s. Margaret Thatcher was in charge. Yes.
All right, here are your championship roll call. Hulk Hogan, as we mentioned, is our WWF Heavyweight Champion. Defeated the Iron Sheik on 123-84 at MSG, ending Sheik's 28 days as champion. And he is now about a year into his reign, 364 days, Scott. I guess. How does that work out? Was it like a leap year or something? I don't know. Or not a leap year?
No, yeah. That's really weird. I guess it was.
Well, no, 125. Yeah, right? Shouldn't it be like 366? I don't know. Something's going on.
Will be three. It was 24. Yeah, it'd be 366. Should be, yeah.
Sudden math. Greg Valentine defeated Tito Santana on the 924-84 show at the London Gardens in London, Ontario, Canada, ending Tito's 226-day reign as IC champion. Hammer is now 119 into his. Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch are our tag team champions. Defeated Rocky Johnson and Tony Atlas on the 717-84 show at the Agricultural Hall in Allentown, Pennsylvania, 279 days into their reign. And Wendy Richter defeated the Fabulous Moolah on 723-84 at MSG, ending Moolah's 205-day reign, or whatever you want, 17,000-day reign.
Or yeah, 5 zillion-day reign, yeah.
184 days into Richter's reign as champion. So on this day as well, this exact day, 121-85, Florida Championship Wrestling promoter and former NWA president Eddie Graham committed suicide after battling alcoholism, shot himself, so... sad moment there. Some of these matches aren't in prime time. We could talk about that later. Originally scheduled match as well was supposed to see Tonga Kid teaming with Jimmy Snuka against Roddy Piper and Bob Orton. So we'll talk about that as well. So any thoughts there on the notes?
No, not at all. I mean, Eddie Graham dying was a terrible tragedy for a thriving promotion in the southern area. That was what the doctor watched when he was a kid, and it was very sad. It was sad for the business. And 1985 would also be about the time when Jim Crockett Promotions would start to also come into their own. Starrcade 83, probably one of the greatest shows ever, one of my favorites. But then Starrcade 84 was not great. So they were trying to bust out and emerge as a major player in the wrestling landscape as well as we begin the year in 1985. But otherwise, an exceptional first report for Margaret Thatcher's assistant.
Yes.
Oh! So... all right. Let's head to the garden. God, that sounds so great, doesn't it? Our opener, JR. This is going to be fantastic. We're going to have – this is the best part of this, though. You know, some of these matches – here we used to say, and on the international heat, you know, Tigerelli Singh beat, you know, some scrub. But the scrub matches are just as entertaining and just as much fun to talk about as the matches like with the actual superstars. So our first match – is one half of a pretty well-known heel
tag. I don't know about popular. Yeah, well
popular, known. But well-known heel tag team, former champions, taking on one of the more well-known jobbers of our era, JR. Who do we got?
Well, we do have Moondog, as you referenced the tag team we're talking about, Moondog Rex taking on Terry Gibbs. Yes, so it's kind of the very first match on this trek is Moondog Rex versus Terry Gibbs in front of, like you said, a pretty strong MSG crowd. So that crowd, though, is pretty ambivalent to start here. Fink announces the main event just before this starts, which I thought was odd timing. So, like, the guys are in the ring. He's like, and just to let everyone know, here's tonight's main event. So pretty basic in the early going here with Matt Work and Gibbs controlling the arm. Gene and Gorilla discuss the Moondog bone as Rex keeps trying to power free, but Gibbs keeps him grounded. Gibbs ducks his head and gets kicked in the mush as Rex goes to work, gouging the eyes and kicking and clubbing away. Rex uses a stun gun and then focuses on the chest and neck. Gibbs fights out of a chin lock and dodges an elbow, but then misses one of his own. Rex eats some knees on a splash, but regains control quickly and goes back to the chin lock, as Gene says he has been disciplined so far. Gibbs fires up and starts to slug away, and it's an inverted atomic drop as the crowd gets behind him. He runs Rex into the corner and rakes the eyes and chest as Gorilla calls Rex a sponge that absorbs punishment, which I thought was funny. Gibbs barely takes Rex over with a back suplex as for one as Rex gets his foot on the rope. Gibbs drops his head yet again, allowing Rex to hit a neck breaker for the win. Honestly, not as terrible as I expected. They stuck to a pretty basic match structure, standard house show opener to get everyone settled in. Gibbs played the role of the guy that is one step away from piecing it together. I thought he did that well enough, but Rex was a veteran that took advantage of the mistake. And I was kind of glad they didn't go overly long with it either. So do you have the official time? I meant to note it down here. I can pull it up.
It was like, you know,
I don't want Mike. I want the official time. The official time. Pull it up for me.
Well, keep talking.
Graham. Go to Graham.
Go to more. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. Okay. Go to more. Talk about more. Has Sutton given me more notes? Thatcher?
So I'm
going to
give my. I got a couple more thoughts here. So,
all right, go ahead.
And we should mention, Scott, that we had talked about before how we're going to do match grades, which we've never really done in the past on these podcasts. We kind of established ourselves as guys who don't do quarter stars way back when. And when we started our written Vintage World refreshers, I kind of wish we had done the quarter stars, but we for some reason decided not to again. So since we'll be using those for a lot of this information, we're going to still avoid. So we're going half stars only, no quarter stars. And I went exactly a half star on this match. I thought it was just enough here to keep it from being a complete dud, mainly because it was short. And I, you know, Rex, the Moondogs to me, as we'll see as we go through this trek here, I thought were passable as veterans, you know, undercard gatekeepers to help these younger guys or newer people or whatever break in. They're fine pace setters. They have just enough offense to keep the match intriguing. They bump just well enough to have the comebacks be hot and the opening shine to be hot. Like they're just serviceable enough to get you to the half a star point, you know, and then it could go from there. But rarely, I think, we're going to see Moondog dud matches, only because they're so well-versed in just veteran basics, especially in this house show format where they're not asked to be performing for TV, per se, or pay-per-view or feuds. You know, they're just out there wrestling a very basic match. So, to me, they're just as serviceable. Terry Gibbs, I didn't see much in him. He was pretty juiced up. But again, just a guy that the crowd didn't seem too into as a face. So I didn't see much going on with him here that would make me think he was going to climb the ladder anytime soon. I thought Rex actually looked better than him. But that's where I landed, a half a star on that one.
The official time is 10:14.
Okay.
So not the longest match on the card. Thank God. Yeah, I'm going to give it a half star, too. You know, typical jobber opener. At least it wasn't a long draw kind of thing. But we will continue the three steps. And the three steps will be fascinating since there will be a lot of, oh, wow, I remember that on Raw. No, it's not going to happen. Step one, I'm going to talk more about Madison Square Garden because pre-1984, the Garden looked nothing like it did at this point. What you're seeing now in January of 85 is pretty much the look that the Garden would have pretty much for the rest of its existence in the Federation era. Pre-1984, so in other words, the last house show at Madison Square Garden in 1983, December 26th, which of course was the show that Iron Sheik beat Bob Backlund, the Garden was very dark. The canvas was dark. The ropes were like gray. They might have been red, but I think they were gray. And it just looked like a bland arena that just looked like every other arena. Like it looked like a territory arena. And I think Vince realized, I think this is one of these things where Vince realized, I need to snazz this place up because if this is going to be our house, if this is going to be the home office, it can't look like the basement. It's got to look like the penthouse. So the next house show, which is January 23rd, 1984, we all know what happened that night, everything changed. The building's brighter. The canvas goes from kind of a dark gray to a lighter gray. The ropes are no longer gray. They're now red, white, and blue. And we finally get the distinct MSG ring bell. When you hear that bell, you know what arena you're in. And the three main house show venues that we saw over the years, well, four, I guess. Madison Square Garden, the Spectrum, Boston Garden, and Maple Leaf Gardens all have something distinct. The Spectrum used to have the logo on the canvas, so you kind of knew. Boston Garden, of course, had the gold wood on the floor that covered the ice. Of course, the Bruins played there, and the big Panasonic logo that was always in the background. And Maple Leaf Gardens, as you know, of course, had the ramp. But MSG had the red, white, and blue ropes and the bell. The ring bell was Madison Square Garden, and of course, the big cool MSG mic flag that used to come down that Fink used to talk into. Step two, Terry Gibbs, baby, the pride of New Haven, Connecticut. He was the only guy that ever said from New Haven, Connecticut. And step three, these are the things about Mean Gene that used to annoy me. Like he obviously wasn't meant for color commentary. I don't know if he did it a lot in the AWA, but he didn't really know what he was doing. He belabored the fucking bone hanging off the pole for like 8 of the 10 minutes of this match.
He did. And it becomes a running thing.
Yeah, it becomes so tedious. Yeah, it's so tedious. Gorilla, I'll get more into Gorilla's play-by-play as the night progresses, but he's got a little experience. Obviously, he did it for most of 84, but now that we're really going to look at it, we're going to see some of the chinks in the armor. But Gorilla's still Gorilla, and he's pretty solid. But his energy level's not as high as it would be in a couple months.
Well, you can't blame him with these house shows. I mean, I don't think it's meant to be. He's not out there really hard selling anything. He's just calling the action for a very limited audience. Actually, it's funny because I came in with the preconceived notion that Gene was terrible, mainly because you've said it and D'Amato said it forever. I actually didn't think he was that bad. I mean, he has his moments. Of course, you prefer to have the heel in there because that's really what we're used to and we know how good it can be. But I don't know. I thought he added enough flavor to the show to not make it completely bland. We'll see more as we move along, but I don't know. We'll track it.
Okay.
So far, though, at least one match in, and I think he's fine.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So Moondog Rex wins in the official time of, and we'll give you the official times of 10:14, and
that's
we each
job.
Give it.
I'm leaving
a
that
half
to
star.
You. The times. That's gonna be
yeah. So the times, phone. And courtesy of our very good friend Graham Cawthon.
There you go.
And the history of WWE.com, and of course I'm using obviously the website, but if the computer is inaccessible to you at the moment, if you're listening on your iPhone or iPad or whatever, you can always grab the book if you bought it. Mm-hmm. I'm sure, Graham will appreciate the plug.
Pull it off the shelf.
What?
So pull it off the shelf.
Pull it off the shelf with the DVDs. Next up, JR, one of two technically they're all debuts, but the first of two debuts for these people in this building, and somehow it seems like they would have a pretty decent career. Well, one of them would anyway. We have the Pride of Nice, France, JR, taking on this chunky little guy from Calgary. What do we got?
So, to kind of lay out the format of what we're the formatics, as some fools may say, of what we're going to do,
idiots,
how we're going to run this thing. If it's a guy like Bret Hart who is going to be on many other shows and makes pay per view appearances or Saturday Night Main Event appearances, we're going to really dive into his career when they debut. Then, the house shows are bios and fun facts. As far as the bio, the bio angle goes, it'll be more around the guys that don't ever progress to that level. So, like Rene Agrelet, which we'll talk about in a minute. So, Bret Hart will briefly mention what he was doing around this time. We'll dive into his full bio when he makes his either Saturday's Main Event or pay-per-view debut, because we're working in conjunction with our Refresh reviews and tying things in. So, just to give a little background as to why we may not dive fully into a Bret Hart on a show like this, we're going to reserve that more for the other guys. So, Bret Hart, this is his MSG debut, had been working house show since August of 84 after Stampede Wrestling was purchased by the World Wrestling Federation. This is his first match at the Garden. And again, we'll talk more about his history later. Robert Bedard, better known by his ring name of Rene Goulet, began wrestling in 1957 in Quebec City, Quebec. During his career, he spent time in both the AWA and WWWF during the 70s and 80s, won the tag team gold in the promotion with Carl Gotch as his partner in December 1971. Goulet was known to be a solid wrestler that would carry a match, which is why he was typically tapped to wrestle rookies, where he could carry his end of the bout. Many top names get early starts against Goulet, including Ric Flair, the Iron Sheik, Greg Gagne, Ken Patera. And as a fun fact, Goulet was the first person to ever defeat Ric Flair during his career. Also was in the first ever WWF televised match on USA against Tito Santana, so... solid hand was Rene Goulet, and we'll be seeing plenty of him, Scott, as we move along through these shows.
Oh, yes, we will.
All right, so we're going to showcase for the young babyface Bret Hart, who is a babyface, against the Michael Jackson of the WWF because he wore a glove like Michael Jackson. And I'm hoping that's where the comparisons end.
I know.
I'm guessing he doesn't sing like Michael. I'm guessing he doesn't have the money of Michael Jackson and hopefully nothing else going on. None of the funny business going on at the Neverland Ranch. We get a funny shot of two middle-aged ladies all dolled up sitting ringside. You'll see that picture if you go to PlayStation.com. Goulet's so absurd with that glove and that hair. Just an odd gimmick that he had going on here.
That beard.
Everything. And then Gorilla, as another thing we should probably track as we move along, because it's very Gorilla. Notice that Rene has dropped 25 pounds. So he always comments on the weight.
Oh, I'll get to that. Oh, yeah.
Either basically saying this guy needs to get back on the gas, or this guy's a little too fat. So that's pretty much how he delivers his comments. So Goulet slithers to the ropes to break a Bret go-behind. Bret keeps grabbing limbs, but Goulet breaks them up and stalls until he finally settles on working the arm. Goulet takes over on offense, grabs a bear hug as Gene gives his background as an amateur in France. Bret claps to the head to break free, but Rene slugs him down and bites his nose. Goulet eventually hooks on the scorpion claw, but Gorilla jokes it won't be as effective because he doesn't have the glove on. that hand. Brett battles to his feet and punches free, but eats a forearm on a charge, and Goulet goes back to the claw, but Brett again gets free and grabs a sunset flip for two. Goulet kicks him in the head and goes to a chin lock before again going back to the claw. Brett fights out of it, but Goulet slings him to the floor and then cracks him in the face as he tries to get back inside. Brett climbs on the apron again and flies in with a sunset flip for a good near fall. Renee whiffs on a punch, and Brett hits an atomic drop as the crowd starts to roar. Brett hooks an abdominal stretch, but Goulet quickly wriggles free. Brett pops up and hits a backbreaker and a leg drop. Goulet loads up the hand with a weapon. Brett ducks him, and after a whip reversal and a dodge, Hart is grabbed by, or grabs an Oriental Sleeper, as it's called in commentary, for the submission win.
That was fantastic.
A decent little match, I thought. It was some nice selling by Brett. I thought it was a good comeback. The crowd was into it. I thought the three claw holds was too much. I thought they could have mixed it up and had a different hold in there. That caused it to drag a little bit, but I thought it was effective overall and scoring Brett a good win over a veteran like Goulet in his MSG debut. I thought Hart looked solid as a babyface player here. The crowd was already buying into him. I went one star on this. Wasn't much more than that. What was the official time, Scott?
The official time was 14:32.
Yeah, so a little long. And again, I think they could have cut one of the claw holds and maybe shaved a little bit of time off of this thing, or at least mixed up the hold. I did like I popped for the Oriental Sleeper call, though. Mm-hmm. But I thought Brett looked like an up-and-comer on this one as a face.
Yes, it was weird seeing him in the short tights, and he's you know, everybody used to goof with him, and he had his little chunky baby fat still on him, but I thought he worked the match well. I think a star is fine here. I could be generous and say a star and a half, but I'll keep it at one, because they kind of, you know, you're right, they bunched the claws together. Step one, I love Goulet's heel beard. You were talking about his look. The beard goes away soon. He eventually, because the beard kind of reminds me of like the 83, 84 house shows that we were watching. So that are on the network and before that, he eventually gets rid of the beard. Step two, like I said, Gorilla was still working his play-by-play style, not as engaged as he eventually would be. Sometimes it sounds like he's, oh, look at this. Come on, ref. He's pulling his tights. You know, what's going on here? And then, you know, Mean Gene, oh my God, come on. And Gorilla's like, yeah, come on. He's pulling the tights. And like he's thinking about like his next burger or something, you know. And step three, I thought it was a well worked match. Brett really looked like a guy who was trained well, mm-hmm. not necessarily experience yet. Although he did have some. I mean, obviously he worked for his dad, you know, for a few years. But you know, now this is the big time. This isn't, you know, Medicine Hat or Moose Jaw. I mean, we're talking, you know, we're talking the big time here. And he looked like a guy who always knew that he could direct a match. Like he just had that look in that aspect, and we would see that grow over time. So the Hitman gets the big win in his, but he's not the Hitman yet, and he's Brett with two T's. it changed that quick,
right?
Wins it in 14:32 with a sleeper. Those damn Orientals inventing sleeper maneuvers.
That's what they're trying to do, is put people to sleep so they can steal their opium.
Yep. And then go to the AWA and win the six-man Oriental tag titles.
That's right.
Because there's only one Oriental. There's only one tag title, and it's by the Orientals.
If you want more counts of the awful usage of the word Oriental, go check out World Class. We had Oriental trackers of how many times Bill Mercer said use that word to describe anyone of Asian descent. So
yes,
enjoy
him and Larry Nelson, the guys with beards for some reason. Larry Nelson and Bill Mercer both saying those damn Orientals.
Yes, the 80s were quite a time.
Yes. All right. Next up, JR, another match involving a grizzled tag team veteran against another newcomer, a guy who would kind of get to know the guy we just saw fairly well over time.
Mm-hmm.
And they are?
The Jim the Anvil Neidhart, making his MSG and Dirty F debut, managed by Mr. Fuji for his first couple months, of course, before having his contract sold. Anvil battling the legendary Tony Garea, of course, former
Auckland
tag team champion, yes. And a very similar guy to Rene Goulet in that he's been around for a while, a very solid hand, well-respected, and used a lot on these undercards for quite a while here into the 80s to help put guys over. Of course, he debuted way back in 1972, where he debuted in Philadelphia. So been around for a while, tag team with Rick Martel back in the early 80s, won the tag team titles, and bounced around since then. And after Martel left in A2, Guerrero went on his own, and from there on out, he pretty much just moves to this status, jobber to the stars, putting over the up-and-comers over the next year or two. So,
mm-hmm. Trivia question for you quickly, JR, before you move on. Tony Garea won the WWF and WWF tag team titles five times with four partners. You just name one. twice with Rick Martel. Can you name the other three?
Mm. I wasn't prepared for this.
Think of the era. Yeah, late 70s, early 80s.
Where's Kelly when you need him?
That's right.
I don't know.
I'll give you one that you won't get. Dean Ho.
Yes, Dean Ho. That's right. Dean Ho. I'll just give him the other ones. I'm not going to say it.
Okay. Haystacks Calhoun. I didn't realize Haystacks Calhoun ever had a belt. And one of our favorite Dangerous Alliance guys of all time. Not Will. Larry Zbyszko.
It's a unique team as well. Some funny tag team partners there for.
I know, isn't that wild?
Dino. All right, Dino. Jim Neidhart, the Anvil, looking pretty stout here. Had the gut, but it's not as huge of a gut. Yeah, it's almost just like a beer gut on a really jacked guy. Whereas later it would just become a guy that eats a shitload and get real fat.
Beer's one thing, nachos or something else.
Right here, he just looked like a guy that has swung an axe or worked out in the fields all day, cutting down trees and throwing rocks around. Right, just a real strong man from, like, working out in nature. Like, not, like,
really,
in the gym.
If you looked at, like, those World's Strongest Man contests back then, back in the day, none of those guys looked like Tony Atlas. They were all big fucking fat guys who were just happened to lift, you know, cars.
Right,
you know?
So he's just strong. He's stout and strong. And he's just got this gut because you can tell he just boozes all weekend. So that's that's what he looked like here.
Hot toddy in Calgary.
You know, that's, yeah, that, well, I doubt he's drinking hot toddies.
Oh, no, yeah, I doubt that too.
Guzzling Molson or whatever, but, and Coke. So anyway, so, Gene questions the announced weight of 285, basically saying he should be a lot heavier. Then talks about a Neidhart's legitimate sports background. Gorilla says Gurria's lost 20 pounds. So again, two for two here, after some time off in New Zealand. Looking great. He's down about 20 pounds. Anvil messes. And I like how he talks like 20, 25 pounds like it's legitimately nothing. Like gaining 25 pounds like it's a blink. Dropping 20 pounds like it's nothing. Like, you know, it's to Gorilla, who's always weighed over 400 pounds, it's amazing to hear him talk about 20 pounds like it's a drop in the hat. Anyway.
20 pounds of corned beef sandwiches he was eating during his career, for Christ's sakes.
So Anvil messes with Gurria a bit, teasing a test of strength and showboating. Gurria shakes him up with a crossbody, forces Neidhart to settle down and focus. They finally go to the test of strength, which Anvil wins easily, forcing Gurria to his knees as the crowd cheers him on. Gurria works his way free and goes to the arm, dropping his knee into it and then going to an armbar. Gene references Russ Francis at the time, as a part-time wrestler and football star. We'll see more of Russ in the future. Neidhart turned the tide with an inverted atomic drop and then clubbered away before grabbing a chin lock. Gene puts over Neidhart's background further as he's smothering Gurria in the corner while also working the lower back. Gurria dodges a football charge and sends Anvil throat first into the ropes, but Anvil catches him with a bear hug off a charge. Gurria wriggles free but gets caught again, and this time he gets power slammed to end the bout. Fine enough. I thought it was pretty bland outside of a couple of good power spots. Gurria puts Neidhart over strong. Anvil's big power moves looked very effective as well. I went a half star on this. Again, pretty basic. Nothing that really stood out, but Gurria's so good that to me his baseline will never be a dud. He's similar to the Moondogs, to where he's good enough to at least get to that half star mark with anyone and beyond when he has the right guy. So, would you give this one?
I also gave this a half star. I mean, there's really not much more you could do because I don't think a singles match will ever have more than a half star when it comes to Jim Neidhart. So as he gets older, it's just pretty much going to base. I agree with you about baselining, or in his case, free basing. Speaking of Russ Francis, you know why he mentioned him, JR? The day before, on January 20th, 1985, Russ Francis won his second Super Bowl ring at Super Bowl 19 out in Stanford, when the 49ers beat the Dolphins 38-16 in what would be Dan Marino's only Super Bowl. But Russ Francis, his second ring. And of course, the 49ers had won one 3 years earlier. So that's kind of, I wonder if that's why he mentioned him.
Well, I think he was more making comparison to, that might have been why, but he was also making the comparison to Neidhart, who were both football players and wrestlers, because they made it sound like he was active as a wrestler during this time. And I know he did other stuff. I'm trying to look it up now. So, yeah, he appeared at WrestleMania 2. Son of Ed Francis was at AWA. After
his dad was a wrestler too, right?
He was a promoter, Ed Francis.
Okay.
So he must have been doing something part-time before WrestleMania 2. There's nothing in here specifically. He was an NWA Hawaii tag team champion at one point. So I'm not sure what he was doing wrestling-wise before this, but they definitely call him out as a wrestler, a part-time wrestler. So I don't know if they were fudging it just because, you know, playing off his dad's connection. But he's definitely mentioned here.
Right. Maybe his tag team champion partner in Hawaii was Dean Ho.
Right? Whose is it?
Exactly. All right. Step one, again, as we've talked about, I love everybody's lost 25 pounds. Everybody's faster. Got to be so quick in the ring there, Gene. Everybody's got to be quick in the ring, unless, of course, you're a big fat dude. Step two, this is the first match where Gorilla does the big joke out of knowing parts of the body because they were doing like a, I think it was like a chin lock or something. And he's like, and then you have, and he says it really fast, like, and then you have to do the precipital octuberance behind the jawbone to the side of the, and Mean Gene looks at him like, I'm just going to have another shot. So that's where this is the first match you hear, you know, Gorilla doing that whole gag for the next, you know, 10 years of, knowing, you know, body parts.
And I bet you didn't know that Gorilla and Dean Ho were actually the first tag team champions to use theme music.
I could see Tony Greer dressing like, you know, Fatu in 1995, gigantic leather jackets.
There you go. Played to the ring by Ludacris.
Yep, by Ludacris. And I wonder if they did well in the Orientals market. And step three, I could see why eventually Jim Neidhart's career would go that route. I just didn't feel he had a ring presence. He was just this big fat guy who walked around a lot, did a lot of, you know, bland power moves. I mean, I think it actually probably saved his career to actually, you know, do what he would end up doing later on down the line. I think it was a big deal for him. I think it worked out. It eventually worked out because I don't think he could have survived as a singles guy. He wasn't like Brett. Brett looked like a guy who had that feeling in the ring. Now, I know Neidhart trained in Calgary too, but obviously he's no Brett or any of the other guys that were in, you know, Dynamite Kid or...
Yeah, but he's, you know, it's funny because we always talk about guys who came around too early or too late. I feel like Neidhart actually came around at the right time. Like, if he was to be a singles guy, like, he probably could have had a decent run in the WWF on his own just doing what he's doing here. Like, we saw that one TNT with him in studio where him and Fuji, and, like, I thought he actually showed some good charisma there. So I think him with either Jimmy Hart or Fuji is just a bruiser bodyguard type of guy, almost like what, like, Bubba Rogers would be in the NWA. You know, something like that where...
Yeah, I can see that. Sure.
Like, because he had the legit strongman background, and he had a decent look, had the laugh, had the humor. So I think he could have actually stuck around. I mean, he would have been dropping classics, but if there was ever an era for him to be around, this was it. Was that 84, 85, 86, 87 stretch where he could have hung with the rest of the guys in the company. So while the tag team coming around was a big boon to him, I don't think he's the guy that would have flamed out without it.
I agree with that. I just feel like he would have plateaued as just this low mid-card thug bodyguard guy. And then the career move he made, obviously, was for the better for him. Incidentally, the match length was... how long do you think it was?
Let's take a shot. Six change.
12:05.
Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
I knew you were going to say something like 6 minutes. So Jim Neidhart gets the win. Isn't this great music, Gorilla? Oh,
you know, it's been an awesome song for Dean Ho. No,
Dean Ho's not your enemy. I can see Tony Greer saying that. Wait, I was waiting for him to just mention New Zealand out of the blue. You never know.
There you go.
It would have been tremendous. So, anyway, Jim Neidhart gets the win. Then we actually go backstage, JR, for the first time.
We do. That's where Gene scurries to the back, interviews Don Morocco and Mr. Fuji. Morocco rambles on about his Hawaiian heat warming up the winter as he returns to the Big Apple. I thought this was pretty classic, nonsensical Don Morocco, just rambling on.
Oh, so awesome.
Stephen Graham smiled excitedly somewhere. But yes, this was vintage Morocco, and we'll talk more about him momentarily.
Yeah, like right now, because he is up next, taking on JR, a Place to Be podcast, Federation era icon. And who is that icon?
You tell me. You're the, it's your boy.
There he is. The Sweeter.
Yes.
Sweet Hansen. Love the Sweeter. Tell us about the Sweeter. And the other guy.
Nope, sorry. Here we go. The Sweeter, yes. Robert Ford Hansen, known during his wrestling years as Sweet Hansen, began wrestling in the WWF in 1957. After being trained by George Tragos, was later moved to Pittsburgh to improve his skills before coming back to New York. While in Pittsburgh, he competed against Bruno Sammartino in Sammartino's debut match. Hansen would later move on to the Mid-Atlantic territory to team with Rip Hawk in the Blonde Bombers tag team, returned to WWF in 1979 for a second run with Freddie Blassie. After a brief run up north, he again teamed with Hawk in Texas, where they won tag team gold three times. Hansen here is at the tail end of his career, rejoining the Federation in late 81. Always seen as an honest but intimidating wrestler willing to put over others to further the business and be confined to a hospital with dementia in 2001 and died from sepsis in 2002. What is sepsis, Scott? Can you tell us about sepsis?
It's some kind of infection, I think, because I remember on the episode of The Sopranos when Uncle June accidentally shoots Tony in the stomach, that's what he almost died of, sepsis. So I think it's some kind of like a viral infection or a bacteria.
It's a hell of a cut there to reference The Sopranos to explain a medical terminology that killed Sweet Hansen. Oh, sweet.
Oh, God. There we go.
We love Dean Ho. All right, so give me your thoughts on Morocco here, because they kind of... All right, I'll talk about the match. I'll talk about Morocco, because this is kind of like his reboot. It sounds like he had taken some time off and had gone away, and I'm pretty sure this is early into his run with Fuji, right? I mean, that's what it sounded like when they were talking on here.
Yeah, because during his early 80s run when he was IC champ, he was with Lou. He was with your pal there, the big fat sloppy pig, for the most part.
So yeah, Morocco took a hiatus in August of 84. So this is his return, and now he's joined with Fuji. So this is, I mean, they're talking like it just happened.
Right.
And some of the TNTs from around this time, too, that we've seen, they were talking about, like, this new alliance with him and Fuji. So we're getting in on the ground floor here with the Fuji-Morocco stuff.
Incidentally, the official definition of sepsis is a life-threatening condition that arises when the body's response to infection injures its own tissues and organs.
Sepsis.
That's
awful. Sepsis. Sepsis.
You're going to see so many new great things on the
I don't know. I wouldn't consider this great so far. All right, so good heel Morocco, as always. Interesting matchup here with the Big Sweeter. Before the match, Fink introduces Pedro Morales to the crowd. He gets a big ovation, and Morocco just stands there looking pissed off.
I know.
I love how mad Morocco looks. It was random how they always did this shit. Like, the match is just about to start, and it's because they had everyone's attention. Like, what is the reasoning to do this here? Like, the guy's standing in the ring waiting, and you bring someone in for a meet and greet. It was an odd decision.
I think they did it because probably to pop Pedro returning, because I think he was in...
No, but why not do it between matches? I never understood why they did this stuff, like, once the guys are in the ring right before the bell.
Well, the only other one that we really know, which we'll talk about again down the line, was when they did it with Snuka at WrestleMania 5. But...
Yeah, but it happens even... We'll see. It happens throughout. Like, this isn't just this match
and that. This one kind of made pseudo-sense because Pedro and Morocco feuded. In fact, Morocco...
I know, but it's not limited to this, is what I'm saying. It's just a weird trend.
It might be a case-by-case basis. This one might be because they want to kind of add some Morocco's heat because him and Pedro feuded for the IC belt. But I understand you're saying. I'm just giving you the specific reason for this one. It's probably a case-by-case basis depending on the arena or some kind of crap like that. So.
Whatever. I just don't get why you can't do it between the match. Mm-hmm. This seems awkward. But Morocco looked annoyed too. So Sweet's hair is awful, by the way. That's it.
It is pretty bad.
Makes Armento look like fucking Fabio. Morocco wins the lockup and grabs the side headlock, but we get a stalemate on a shoulder block. Swede slams Morocco with ease. Don begs off as Gene puts over Hansen's strength. Gene and Gorilla talk about the effect Fuji will have on Morocco's career, but he's struggling here with the Sweeter as Swede slams him hard to the floor or to the mat and then bails outside to regroup. Morocco heads back in and traps Swede in the corner and then lands some chops. Swede comes right back and slams Morocco again. Swede goes to work the arm for a while, mixing in an armbar and a chicken wing. Morocco takes over with knees to the gut and a kamikaze drop. Swede makes a near immediate comeback as another slam. Morocco tries a slam, but Swede collapses on him for a near fall. Morocco slips out of another slam and dropkicks Swede into the corner and then hits an inverted pile driver for the win. That was a real shit match. Swede gave nothing out there. He just kept going to his slams. It was worse than the fucking Goulet claw hole. They have like 8 slams was his offense, and that was it.
Yeah.
Morocco gets like no offense in, hits the finish. And I thought for a guy that's trying to reestablish off an injury with a new manager as a top heel, they didn't give him any shine at all. I would have thrown in, I would have put like Terry Gibbs or something here with Morocco that could have actually just worked with him a little bit or fed him or Gurria even. Swede just gives him nothing. He just stonewalls him and then slams him over and over and then just takes the one move and bails on it. It was just a weird way to establish Morocco. To me, you use this for a guy that is already established that you're just having a throwaway match. For Morocco, you're reintroducing him. He's been gone for 6 months or so, 5 months. He's got a brand new manager, new heel run, and you throw him in here with this Jamoke who is just feeding him nothing at all and just sandbagging him the whole way. Worst match of the night so far.
Yeah, I gave this a zero. Very disappointed in the sweeter that he didn't. Yeah, it was just there was nothing there. And again, I'm not like Stephen Graham crazy about Morocco, but I'm a big Morocco guy, and I may have to debate this with a future guest. But this was a match that he needed to kind of like really mangle somebody, and then maybe, well, he couldn't dedicate the pile drivers, which he would do later on with heel guys. But step one, the sweeter. That's all I got to say. Although he was disappointing here. Step two. Let me tell you something. People could say whatever they want about Morocco, but when he's – even though he was probably past title contention phase, although at the time he didn't know that, he brings heat. I mean, the crowd was pretty nuclear – well, I don't say nuclear, but the crowd was pretty hot for him. So whatever anybody wants to say about Morocco, the guy could bring the heat to the ring regardless of who his opponent was. And step three, you'd mentioned it before – I think it just added heat to Morocco. I understand what you're saying about just random, hey, by the way, here's this guy. I get that. I think this one was for a specific reason, and that was to kind of, you know, amp the juice of Morocco's heat. But in a general sense, yeah, I agree with you. Sometimes you're like, well, why are you doing this now? I think this instance it was because of that. And Morocco wins. It's a stinker. And we're going to talk more about Morocco in the next couple of shows. Because he takes a weird booking turn, considering this is his like reinvention or reigniting of him as a character.
What'd you think of using Fuji with him?
I thought it was great. Morocco had enough juice to be on his own, but even in that instance, back then, managers weren't there as mouthpieces all the time. Managers were there to be dual heat. And even though Morocco could probably survive on his own as a heel without a manager, Fuji was a good choice. I wouldn't have put Bobby with him.
Well, he didn't need the talker. So if Fuji's very limited, obviously, in his talking.
Right.
So he's not going to – he was more with the guys who were either mysterious or devious that could explain his deep, dark oriental pasts. or a guy that could talk and just – they wanted the attachment of the heel manager. And viewer edification, I'm coming into this. I'm really working hard to clean the slate on all these guys I've had, you know, thoughts of that I've hated all these years for whatever reason.
Right.
Like, you know, I'm not a big Fuji guy, but I'm going into this with a clean mind.
Open-minded.
And you know what? It worked with Albano. I'll say we're doing those TNTs. I've actually come around on them, specifically once he turned face. Some of those early ones with him as a heel were rough, but I opened my mind to Albano with the TNTs and he's won me over a bit, so I don't hate him as much as I used to. So we'll see if Fuji can do the same as we continue to watch more.
I agree with you on that. The fucking, I think Butcher Vachon's wedding was his nadir. You know how there's a zenith? Well, his nadir of annoyance.
Ralph?
Was, yes, right. Yeah. Yeah, because the Green Party, how important are they? And was that TNT when he was just so fucking annoying. Drunk. He probably was doing blow with Vince. I mean, that episode is a disaster. And yeah, once he turns face and kind of does the whole Cyndi Lauper thing, he becomes a lot more tolerable. So.
All he does is body slam.
Nader.
And no sell.
I love Ralph Nader.
All right. Here we go.
All right. Okay. Next up. a pair, JR, of tag team specialists.
Mm-hmm.
And both former tag team champions meeting here. And a little bit of history in this match as well, JR, and you'll tell us that shortly.
Yes, and you may have read about this a bit on our Excellent Adventure as well. So a lot of crossover early on here for us.
Yes, it's tremendous.
We have Moondog Spot taking on Blackjack Mulligan, of course, the patriarch of the Wyndham Mulligan group family, father to Barry Wyndham and Kendall Wyndham and mm-hmm. all the other Wyndhams. So is that the only two? I think so. So
yeah, it's only two. Yes, it's only two, yes.
And Scott, the historical note that you mentioned is the debut of the first ever woman female referee, Rita Chatterton, known in the ring as Rita Marie, makes her debut here. Billed as the first female referee in WWF in 1992, of course, things eventually spiraled because she would claim on Geraldo that McMahon had sexually assaulted her back in July of 86. The charge of McMahon denied. McMahon later sued Chatterton, Rivera, and other media outlets that aired the accusations. The case was later dropped so McMahon could concentrate on the steroid case against him. So they really hyped this thing up. We saw a lot about it on TNT as part of a big showcase. She had an interview. You know, a fairly decent-looking chick coming out here and refereeing this match. And I thought she was fine as a referee, I guess. I don't know. It was pretty progressive of them at the time, though. This is 1985. They made a big deal about having a female referee. I thought it was unique that they attempted this. I wonder if they tried to get her to wrestle or do something else, or if they wanted to go the referee route for a specific reason.
I'm curious if I think they were going the referee route for a specific reason. Because the other woman that they would have on the show a lot, on TNT a lot, was, what's her name? Lisa Sliwa, Curtis Sliwa's wife.
Oh, I think it meant Sarah the Soothsayer.
Okay, yeah, her too. And she was different. I mean, she was hot, and she was actually working to be a wrestler. I think she was always meant to be a ref. Maybe she was a backstage or worked for the company and wanted to give it a shot. But I'll be honest with you, after watching that TNT, I don't think it was Vince that should have got sued. I think it was Alfred. I think Alfred was raping her on the couch or something. I think that's even worse. I think he was the one that should have got – and then he does it again in November at the Wrestling Classic with What's-Her-Face. But it was. But on a serious note, it is very revolutionary. I mean, not to say that they're sexist in the South, but, I mean, do you think Crockett would have ever had a female ref? I seriously doubt it. So I think this is pretty revolutionary for the WWF to have a female referee. It's a big deal.
Good job, pal. All right, so debut of Rita, as we talked about. A good pop from Mulligan. Interesting Hoss battle here. Announcers hype up the female ref debut. We get a couple of power stalemates to start things off as Gorilla mentions Mulligan's infamous glove. Mulligan slams Spot and whips him around before grabbing the arm. We have good structure to some spots here where Rita has to show her authority, which actually draws some boos. Spot bails to regroup and then draws Mulligan out where the Moondog whacks him in the gut and head with a chair. Spot cracks him in the gut again right in front of Rita, who's just a bit lax out there apparently, just lets it go. Spot stomps and clubs away in the ring, but Mulligan quickly fires back and hammers away. After another minute of brawling, Blackjack gets an inside cradle for the win. Again, an absolute nothing match. Solely here just to showcase Rita. The chair shots added some interest, but barely even a heat segment. No cohesion at all. And maybe I take back a bit of what I said about the Moondogs guaranteeing you a half a star because this did not get there. Full dud for me. The weird thing, too, with Rita, were they setting her up to be like a face? I mean, are all referees faces? It was an odd thing to like try and build a character around a referee that we're supposed to maybe care about. And then she gets the shit on because she's a referee and everyone hates officials. So it's kind of a weird, I don't know. I don't know what they were trying to do, but it was just weird overall. What do you think of the match itself? And then any other thoughts on Rita's alignments?
Well, just to backtrack a little bit, we did the sweeter. The sweeter Morocco match was 10:54 and this match was 6:40. So, I mean, I thought she was okay. I mean, isn't it weird that, like, 1985, still WWF crowds were still very different than maybe even 5 years later in 89, 90. The crowds were still very much older women, older guys, you know, some kids, but mostly a kind of an older audience. So I didn't think they would boo, like, refs, you know what I mean? I think refs are always supposed to be, like, the flag bearer of you know, following the rules and that kind of thing. I think the best part about it was they picked a match of two guys like nobody really cares about at the time. It's not like they didn't do the main event or put her in like the tornado match or something. I'm sure Piper would have patted her ass or something. This was probably the right kind of match for her, but I don't think you ever see her again. Well, you maybe do. I'm sure that you'll probably see her in future house shows, and they don't really mention her anymore. Step one, we talk about the female referee, the TNT episode you have to watch. Step two, there's really nothing more to say. I mean, the match is very basic. Spot, you know, Mean Gene Harp's the fucking bone again. Yip-de-yap-de-a. And then step three, I think it was good for Vince to at least, even if the matches are not great, reintroducing some of these guys that were Vince Sr. guys, like a Blackjack Mulligan, like a Sweeter, like a Morocco, who were big Vince Sr. guys from like 77 to like 83, and kind of reintroduce them to what could be a new audience, considering, you know, the expansion of television and the expansion of the cable landscape. So that was, I think that was important. Were the matches great? No, not really. But introducing the new characters, I think, was a big deal at the time, particularly those that were big during Vince Sr.'s time. And I think Vince Jr. wanted to still be very loyal to his dad and to the guys that helped make his dad's company what it was in the 70s and early 80s. So I didn't have a problem with that, but the matches were shit, just like this one was. And so Blackjack Mulligan gets the win over Spotty and the Stinky Bone at 6:40.
Yeah, Mulligan's just Mulligan. Yeah. He's a guy that had the look, and I know he was like a great with the Blackjacks and a great heel, you know, AWA or whatnot. Just it felt like a guy that they brought in just to hang around here. And he'll even come back again in like 87, where it's like really played out. But
it's very played out in 87. Yes. Yes, I agree. All right, next up, JR, probably our first – oh, actually, we have an interview. We go backstage.
Yeah, we do. We're Mean Gene interviews Bobby Heenan and Ken Patera. Riffs about Andre the Giant getting his hair cut and says that John studded his hair tonight and has Patera's back. Is it all right if I admire my body? Which was a fantastic Patera line.
Tremendous.
Patera credits Heenan for putting everything together and threatens Gene and promises to slap Andre's head and slam him. And it's a lot of fun getting to talk about heel Patera because, as you know, as many of you know, in our other Vintage Vault discussions and whatnot, the only Patera we really get to discuss is the comeback Patera with the creamy legs and the poofy hair and just awful promos and a mess after being in jail. Heel Patera is a whole different bag of oranges. So, I mean, this is a lot of fun to talk about him in this room.
Yeah, I love that. Did you kiss your arm? Yes. Can't I enjoy my body?
Fantastic.
Fucking fantastic. So was. He was a guy you almost thought didn't need Bobby, but I'm going to – well, you do your analysis, and I want to talk about Bobby because it was okay. The Bobby that maybe later fans knew was not this Bobby. Mm-hmm. This Bobby is very different, but go ahead.
All right. So Patera, Andre's the match, and, of course, this is playing off of – the haircut, the raping of the dignity of Andre the Giant, which was played out very thoroughly.
I think Vince kind of overdid that on TNT, saying, your dignity was raped.
Yeah, he's trying to get it over. Of course, it was Patera and Stud, and they attacked Andre and the useless SD Jones laying around doing nothing as Andre got knocked out and had his afro shorn by the Heenan family, and that would ignite quite the feud, as we'll chronicle over the next couple months. So this is a really big deal and a really big match to open up 1985 in MSG. Andre's, you know, in this death war with the Heenan family, specifically these two guys, and the heat on Patera and Bobby is crazy. The fans are jacked for this. Mega pop for Andre. Gorilla and Gene going crazy, putting Andre over. Patera stalls, but once things start, Andre just smacks him around and sends him scurrying to regroup with Bobby. Andre keeps clobbering him, and when Patera bails again, this time Andre stomps on both of their hands to a huge ovation. And it's such a great atmosphere for Andre here. It's just like amazing buzz in the arena, the feel when he comes out and he's just heads above everyone else. It's such a good, awesome moment, just anytime he's out there. And again, the atmosphere is just crazy. As Patera comes back in, Andre just laughs at him and then wildly chokes away at him, showing tons of great anger and hatred. Andre's just so pissed off and really showing it all here. Patera again bails to the floor. The match continues that pattern where Andre just brutalizes him and Patera keeps bailing out or tries to escape. Andre's just enjoying wrecking Ken, standing on his stomach, leaning on his neck, doing anything he could to punish him. Andre eventually follows him outside, gets slung into the guardrail. Back inside, Andre starts arguing with the referee. that allows Bobby Heenan to clobber him off the top rope with a weapon from behind to draw the DQ. Heenan keeps slugging away and knocks Andre on his back. Andre recovers and smacks Patera and Heenan around as the crowd is buzzing. Pretty much a squash, but I thought it was a lot of fun. The crowd loved it, absolutely loved it. It made total sense. Andre needed revenge after getting his head shaved. So having him come out here and just destroy Patera is what everyone wanted to see. Patera selling and bumping was really good. He let Andre just beat the shit out of him. Andre gets some revenge, but the way they end it lets us know that this is far from over. So I went one star on this just from the in-ring point of view. But overall, I thought it was a really, really great package, and I thought it did a nice job of giving the fans a taste of revenge on behalf of Andre, but also keeping the story simmering because we got a lot more to go when it comes to this thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll give it a star and a half. I'll throw another half star on there just for Andre's and Patera's selling was fantastic. I mean, he bumped like crazy. I mean, Andre worked him over pretty good. Step one. I would say this is the first main event of the show. This is kind of the way the Garden used to be built, where we'd have, you know, kind of a huge match in the middle, and then after this, obviously, was the intermission, and then you come back for the second half of the show, where there were a couple other great main event style matches coming up. Step two, Andre was crazy over. I mean, it's Andre. It's the boss. You know, there's nothing else to say. Guy was over forever. I thought he looked better with the cut hair. I thought that the long, poofy, you know, mullet kind of thing or whatever, his long hair was kind of reaching the end of the line there. So it looked good anyway. But Patera's hair is just so epic, right? So different, the evil heel blonde,
oh yeah,
you know,
sure,
perfectly coiffed fro compared to the weird haircut when he came back from jail, which speaks volumes. And step three, man, when Bobby was decking Andre with a Nux, he was smacking him. That whole post-match thing with Bobby and Andre, to me, I mean, we'll do awards in a little while, but was one of the most fantastic moments of the night for me. And I think that's why I think over the next 5 years, I think Andre and Bobby are like two peas in a pod, both as adversaries and, you know, as we see on the line. They worked so well together. They really did. And I'm sure they worked together, you know, when they made the rounds and when Andre made his stops in the AWA back in the day. This whole package beginning to end was just tremendous. Just tremendous.
It was really good, too. It gave Andre something to really latch on to and be part of,
right,
without being in the title mix.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't have him there right now. So you need something for him to be really tied up in. And it helped get Heenan over as this real high-level heel manager.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of cool parts to this that helps both guys. It helps establish Heenan as a mastermind that wants to torment the Giant, which many people maybe avoided in the past because they're afraid of him. And it also keeps Andre tangled up in a red hot feud with multiple guys, including John Studd, who's pretty much his size. So you're not just battling tiny guys without being too worried about the world title. So I thought it was a really nice feud overall to help both guys along. And the head shaving thing is iconic. You know, I'd never really seen the whole match, so watching it as part of that TNT
and then seeing it play out here. Yeah.
So seeing it all play out has been really, really cool to give some background, and it helps, you know, the build into what we're going to see in a couple of months. So the whole thing was really well done.
Yep. And what I was saying earlier before your analysis about Bobby, Bobby was a lot more vicious. He was a lot more serious than he would end up being even by like 1987, 88. Like by 88, he became the Bobby we all knew. You know, a little more, I mean, he was still a heel, but he was a little more comedic in his delivery. Bobby was still the AWA, you know, Bockwinkel manager Bobby, very serious, even with the weasel chants. He was tremendous. I mean, he was fantastic. Even though it took him a while to get some gold, other managers would get ahead of him in that aspect. He was just so over, and this whole package was great. Him and Andre worked well together, and kudos to Patera. To put over Andre as well, even though he didn't get pinned, which I thought was kind of interesting. That match length, I don't think
needed to. I mean, you're building to so much here that I think it was just enough to see Andre kick the shit out of him. I mean, everyone knew Andre dominated the match and Heenan cost him, so I was actually fine with the finish not having Patera eat any kind of pin, because they're really just getting started with all of this. So,
right.
You know, you got to keep it fresh for rematches going forward at MSG. So I'm cool with the way they did things. And Heenan interfering adds a nice dynamic to really remind us that, the you know, he's the mastermind of this whole thing. Patera and Stud are unleashing the violence, but Heenan's the guy Andre really wants to wipe out. So he beats the shit up Patera, but we're not getting any kind of resolution as yet because we're just starting.
Right. And Graham does not have a time for this match. So it was probably what, maybe 7 minutes, probably something like that.
Yeah. Would you go for a grade?
You said one, right? I said one and a half, okay. Because I gave it an extra half just for the entertainment value. It was that fun. All right. Well, since this was probably the intermission at the Garden, why don't we take an intermission as well? And when we come back, we have, let's see, four matches left. Two of them, main event level, big time, including an iconic clip that would be seen on hundreds, I think, of videotapes over the next 5 years.
I hope it's a wedding.
First. No, it's not. Sweet Hanson's wedding. Because...
can't turn a hoe into a housewife. Hoes don't act right. It's hoes on a mission and it's hoes on a track fight. Hey, ho, how you doing? Where you been? Probably doing hoe stuff, because there you hoe again.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following...
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I just want to make sure you're all subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Now, it's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search for and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation Wrestling Feed, Place to Be Nation Pop Feed, Pro Wrestling Only Feed, and, of course, the Kevin Kelly Show Feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And of course, as always, enjoy all the great action of Ring of Honor Wrestling and everything presented to you on PlaceToBeNation.com.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com, and we offer them to you across two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast with our famous vintage vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with the smash hit Clotheslines and Headlines, our steady veteran main event, and the beloved monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on all pro wrestling super shows. Relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the always contentious Dangerous Alliance podcast, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. On our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, NBA Team, Lucha Undead, Geek and Sassy, and a veritable podcast heaven for comic fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both of those feeds on iTunes and rate and leave feedback for us as well. All of these shows plus others available at PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks via the links on the right-hand side of our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The PWO PTBN feed has changed its name, now known simply as Pro Wrestling Only, so it should be easier to find and indeed to say. All of your favorite shows are still here, including Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, This Week in Wrestling, and many, many more, including our full archives of tremendous content. So make sure you subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only feed today.
All right, Nation, we are back here, episode 427 of the Place to Be Podcast, our reset, official revisiting back to 1985. We're talking about Madison Square Garden House Show from January 21st. And you hear a little music under it, Scott. Be kind of part of the overall package of what we do here each and every week. We're going to be playing the number one song in the country the week of the show we're discussing. So, as you hear underneath us, is Madonna, Like a Virgin, was the number one song here in January of 1985. Any memories of that song, Scott? Anything you want to cover off on it?
I was 12. I was 11, so I don't know what you're...
So it resonated.
Well, duh!
Okay, well, stay
with us. What do I...
In the ghetto. So this isn't a this really isn't like a joke about your age. I'm really curious.
No.
This I was obviously 4 at this point.
Mm-hmm.
What was the Madonna craze like in 85? Like, how big was she at this point?
Kind of gigantic.
Okay. So where was she as her stardom? Like, as a 12-year-old, how cognizant were you of her as an entertainer?
Oh, she was huge. My sister had this album. This was like the first big album. Like a Virgin, Material Girl. She was huge here. I mean, she came, I don't know if it was this, I think it was at 85. It was either mid to late 84 or early 85. She came to the New Haven Coliseum. And, I mean, literally every girl between the ages of like 11 and 19 dressed exactly like her with the, you know, the wedding dress from the Video Music Awards and the, you know, the you know, the thing are tied around their heads, the ponytails and the lace gloves and the, you know, bustiers and all that stuff. It was insane. Now, mind you, we had already had a huge craze 2 years or a year and a half earlier with Thriller. I mean, that was the huge album at that time. But Madonna was crazy over.
So where was she? Where was she like compared to Cyndi Lauper at this point? Because obviously Lauper is a big part of what we're going to be talking about over the next few months here on these shows. Was Lauper to her level yet? Or was Madonna already like super established and Lauper?
Well, I think Madonna passed. I think Madonna passed her at this point. I mean, Cyndi was hot, but that album, Girls Just Want to Have Fun and you know, She Bop, mm-hmm. and Time After Time, that was a year and a half earlier. Those songs were all out in 83.
Okay.
So the songs, I mean, I think maybe True Colors, I think, might have been out at this point. Yeah. But she, Madonna was definitely it at this point.
Yeah, and that topped the Hot 100 for 6 consecutive weeks Like a Virgin.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. And then we may see her again later. We'll definitely talk about her again later on in the year. Quick sports note, just to kind of stamp the month. As I mentioned, JR, the day before Super Bowl 19 at Stanford Stadium in Palo Alto, kind of an odd spot for a Super Bowl. But they picked some weird buildings back in the day. The San Francisco 49ers concluded a 18-1 season, best record in the history of the league, well, next to the undefeated Dolphins. The best record in the 16-game era of the NFL. They beat the Miami Dolphins 38-16 in what would end up being, although nobody knew it at the time, Dan Marino's only Super Bowl appearance. Isn't that wild? Only Super Bowl appearance. And he beat the Steelers in the AFC Championship. He set the record that year, 5,084 yards, but could not get the job done against the 49ers. And also, JR, in the month of January, isn't this another thing that's odd? Your college football national champions, BYU. Yes, the Mormons beat Michigan in the Holiday Bowl 24-17. And back in the day when it was strictly about voting, they were voted. They were voted the AP and UPI national champions at 12-0.
I swear that there were two reasons why I've never really gone into college football. One is that there's really no good local team around here to get into. And two, as a, you know, whatever, 10, 11, 12, 13, that age, I couldn't get into them not having a definitive way to name a champion. Like, I remember really liking Michigan. And was it 93? Like, what was the year where they were in the title picture? But it was also fucking confusing as like a 12-year-old. Like, so which game is for the championship? Wait, they're going to win this one and they should be champion. But if the other team wins, they're probably not because the winner of this other game's good. Like, the whole thing was super confusing to me.
The one I remember was 97 between Michigan and
this would have been
earlier. Arizona State.
Okay, there must have been something, and like it was something in 92-93. Michigan was pretty. Anyway, the whole thing was very confusing. And when you had college basketball sitting there with, oh my god, a giant tournament, and here's a winner. Like it was just so much easier to get into.
No, you're right.
you know, not having a local powerhouse team that everyone was into, plus the confusion as a kid of, like, how do you even track what's going on? I think that's why I never really got into college football, honestly, was that fiasco. So it's a, you know, 25 years or whatever after this, but they finally got there. Where we have a specific way to determine champion now. But.
The problem was, I mean, we'll be completely honest. The whole problem at the time was corporations and the NCAA, which is a gigantic rigged mafia anyway, didn't want to give up the money of the bowl games. So if there was any scheme that would devalue the bowl games, it was not happening. And it took a long time before they got their heads out of their asses and changed it and made the bowl games part of whatever could be national champion. But back then, forget it. Rose Bowl, Orange Bowl, Fiesta Bowl, Sugar Bowl, Peach, Blue Bonnet, all the other ones. They were all about the money. They were all about their own personal little, you know, nugget to give the teams, advertising, c'est la vie, voters vote, who cares? And that changed, thank God, you know, way later. But that's pretty much what it was. So what we're going to do is every month we'll kind of snapshot what was going on that month in sports. Let's see, January 85, either Georgetown or St. John's was the number one team in the country. This was the year, JR. And again, you were 4 years old, but the one – I know you like joking about being young, old, but this would have been – considering they were only it was only 5 years in existence, this was the year to be a Big East basketball fan. I mean, it was fantastic. Games at the Garden. The number two thing that sold out in 85 besides you know, house shows was when St. John's played. And they sold out more than the Knicks. Remember, this was the year before. This was the year preceding that draft that they drafted Patrick. And the Knicks were fucking horrendous, and so that, you know, they couldn't draw flies. So the Big East during this time was just red hot, and not just Georgetown and St. John's and Syracuse, but honestly, your Friars were very good in the mid '80s. You know, Ricky P was just getting that team going, so it was just a great time to be a Big East basketball fan in that era. They were just that good. And so we'll document, you know, like we're gonna do with music. We'll document kind of what's going on in sports during this month and that year as well. So your 49ers won their second Super Bowl, and BYU would never come close to this again. Is your national champion? But and Madonna, hottest album, hottest song, and just plain hot.
You know, it's funny too, because the BYU thing caught my eye because I think the version we watched of this on YouTube had it was like from 24/7. So it had the like little this day in history or whatever, and I think it called out the BYU title win, because I remember thinking like BYU won the fucking national championship. Yeah, it was weird.
It was very weird. Yeah,
but anyway.
So, yeah. So there you go. That's what's going on in sports and music in January of 1985. All right, let's continue on. We're on the pretty much this is. I mean, this was obviously the post intermission portion of our program, and we have JR Bobby Heenan really had to keep working because he couldn't take a breather after the fucking beating he just took at the hands of Andre. He had to go right back out there because his other guy was coming out for a match, and who would that be?
I'd be Big John Studd to take on the lovable, beloved George Wells. Oh, George. So, Big John set out there with Bobby Heenan, who's recovering from the last bit of madness that we saw. Do you think it was weird we never saw Studd in that previous match?
I don't remember WWF doing a lot of stuff like, well, maybe they did, I guess.
Yeah, he could have just came out with him or at the end. It was kind of odd because they played it up in the pre-match and then he never showed. And then he's in the next match, so you knew he was here. Because remember, Patera made the big thing about Studd having his back.
Yeah, so. And Bobby pretty much said in the interview, in the pre-match interview, Studd's here. I'm here. Like, he pretty much said it multiple times that right. Studd was there. So, yeah, that it was kind of odd that he didn't help clean up at the end, you know?
Yeah.
Maybe they wanted Andre to go out on top of that segment, maybe. I don't know. That is kind of weird, considering his match was, like, next.
Right, so he's there. Yeah. So, anyway, Studd saunters down to the ring. Just such a calming arrogance about him. Heenan shows up, like, a minute later looking terrible, all out of sorts. Crowd starts to chant Weasel, which gets Bobby into Gene's face with Gorilla fending off Heenan because he starts yelling at Gene on commentary. Wells gets a few punches in, but Studd grabs a top wrist lock Wells breaks free, gets a flurry, including two near slam attempts, but he can't seal the deal for the 15K bounty, which, of course, is out there as well. If anyone can slam John Studd, they'll win $15,000. Studd cuts down Wells off a whip, but Wells comes back with a cross body. Studd shrugs that off and pitches Wells to the floor and then locks him in a bear hug back inside. Wells gets free and nails a sunset flip, but Studd shakes it off and drops Wells with a backbreaker for an awkward three count and win, with Wells popping right up after the three, which is really odd. Really boring near squash with a weird finish. I mean, no sense. I don't think Studd looks strong again at all. Kind of like Morocco earlier. I have no idea why Wells felt an easy kick out at three against fucking John Studd, but whatever. Really nothing going on here. The only thing is they teased the 15K slam, but nothing much else.
The other big favorite heel of mine during this stretch, 84 through into early 86, besides Morocco, was Studd. Studd was awesome, wasn't he? I mean, he just had some fantastic heel presence with him, a lot like Morocco. But it's the first time I ever saw George Wells with hair. Looked like Rick James on roids. It was very, very fluffy. Looked like AC Green. It was very strange. Step two, like I said, Studd was just an awesome heel. I mean, he had such a great presence about him with the beard and the hair and the, you know, the robe. And he was just tremendous. There was just some great, great heels in the WWF in the mid-80s. Great heels. The Horsemen in Crockett. Well, not at the time he didn't, but in Flair and, you know, Tully and Arn and those guys, but in Ole. But the heels in the WWF in the mid-80s were just so good. And Studd was one of them. Just a tremendous presence about him. And step three, it was good that Bobby, and this is a guy who's, you know, you're talking about an attention to detail and a guy who knows his craft. He didn't just come back out and manage Studd. I mean, he sold the fact that Andre just fucking bitch slapped him for about a minute straight and came out all like, you know, like he was punch drunk. And that's, again, that's just a commitment to excellence that Bobby is and a commitment to the business. The match was shit. And what was up George Wells' ass? Like, why would you kick it? I mean, what the fuck? Where do you get off doing that? You're not exactly, you know, you're not sweeter, you know?
No, I know there were some guys that would do that just so they would look strong. I think it was like Iron Sheik has been talked about a lot as a guy that always kicked out just to piss people off or so he wouldn't look soft. But yeah, George Wells' hair is like, what are you doing? Like, you know, you can get up. It doesn't have to be at three, especially for a guy like Studd who's getting into this major feud with Andre the Giant. Just, I don't know who looked worse, him or Morocco, honestly, in what was supposed to be showcase squash matches. Neither got a ton of offense in and or looked super strong in their win.
Yeah, just, I didn't get it. It's George Wells. Nice hair and all, but, I mean, otherwise, what? Just really bizarre. So Big John Studd gets the win. Your time, is there a time for this match? Your time was 7:19. I think some of these squashes are a little too long.
They have to fill the time somehow.
Maybe I know. 7:19.
They look to go about 2.5 hours on all these things. So
yeah, exactly. All right. Next up, do we have a? I don't think we had an interview. I think the only two interviews are the ones we. Oh wait, he does a. Mean Gene does one more later. I don't think there's one here.
No, nothing here.
Next up, JR, probably the second of our three main event matches on this house show, and this match. Oh my God, you want to talk about highly anticipated? That's because you're dealing with, you know, one of the greatest. I mean, greatest heels mm-hmm. ever, and a totally over babyface who is practically brand new. Tell us about this this unique tag match, JR.
Oh, we have Jimmy Snuka, the beloved, teaming with Junkyard Dog, take on Roddy Piper and Bob Orton. Of course, Piper, like we mentioned earlier, had come in 1984, mainly as a manager and eventually as a interview host, but would eventually get into the ring once his injuries cleaned up. And he entered into a blood feud with Jimmy Superfly Snuka and the Tonga Kid. And, I mean, they were rocking Madison Square Garden in arenas all over the country. You know, it's documented very well on the Roddy Piper Coliseum home video. If you haven't ever seen it, they go through pretty much the whole feud. And I mean, you would have thought Tonga Kid was going to be a mega star coming out of that thing. And he's pretty much gone by this point, but Snuka is still super over. The coconut thing only made him even more over, and Piper's heat is through the roof. And this kind of, in a way, is the end of his feud with Snuka. I mean, Snuka's still involved in other stuff that Piper has going on, but he really transitions after this. So in a way, this is kind of their blow off, but not really. Piper, of course, has Bob Orton, who's his ace bodyguard, the cowboy, has his back in all these big feuds. And JYD had debuted pretty recently, right? Scott, did you mention when he debuted? Was it 84?
It was the show before. It was the December 28th, 1984 house show. His MSG debut, he beat Paul Kelly. So he was really, I don't know if he made his, he definitely didn't make his company debut. He was there in the mid-84 because he was on some of our TNTs, but his MSG debut was just this previous month.
Right. So big spot for JYD. Of course, a megastar in Mid-South. So we'll talk more about him when we get to WrestleMania. But big time match, Tornado Rules set up for a wild bout. Snuka and JYD get a huge pop, and the match triggers immediately as they get in the ring. All four pair off and hammer away until JYD and Snuka take over with some double team moves. Orton and Piper stooge around until Orton gets knocked to the outside and crowd gets riled up. Piper baits Snuka onto the apron, and they end up brawling outside as JYD mows down Orton with a clothesline. Piper runs Snuka into the post that he and Orton double-team JYD in the ring. Snuka returns and takes over an all-four brawl in and out of the ring with tons of chaos everywhere. Dick Worley's completely lost out there, the referee, as Piper and Orton take over with a pair of chin locks. Both men power out, but Piper and Orton quickly hook sleepers in a fun bit of match structure. JYD and Snuka keep reaching for each other as the sleepers continue on, but eventually they're able to leverage Orton and Piper into a collision. They all pair off again, slug away at each other with JYD slinging Orton hard into the corner. Piper saves him, and then they double-team Snuka. Orton heads up top but eats knees as he tries a big splash, and then things spill outside as Piper whips Snuka to the rail and trips up JYD, allowing Orton to roll him up for the win. Piper and Orton scurry off as JYD and Snuka chase after them, and the crowd is stunned. But I thought it was a really smart finish to a fun brawl. The match got pretty wild at times. There was some slow spots, but the crowd hung with them. It seemed like the Piper-Snuka feud is fading by this point. They're not really locked on each other. Like, I thought it was interesting that Orton got the win. The Piper and Snuka weren't even featured in the finish. They weren't married to each other throughout the match. The buzz that was there throughout most of 84 around these two seems to have faded a bit as well. And I'll say I was actually a little disappointed. Like, I thought it was a solid street fight, but I had really high hopes with these four guys at this point. And it just didn't really click. I don't know if it was just the lack of heat around Piper and Snuka or just the structure and the setting, but I went 2 stars on this, and it wasn't really what I was expecting it to be. It's still really fun, but I was expecting like much hotter.
I'm actually going to give it 2.5 stars. I really liked it. I thought it had a good flow. That JYD was crazy over. I agree with you on the Piper-Snuka stuff, but I think all four guys worked really hard. And I think tried to get it over. You know, Tornado is not an easy, like you said, Dick Worley looking, you know what the fuck he was doing. But I'll tell you something, a Tornado tag match, even if you're an experienced referee, not easy to try to deal with, particularly when it's a house show match, which isn't a structure to say like a pay-per-view match or something like that. So I'm going to give some props for that. I'm going to knock it up 0.5 star because I think it was a lot better than I think you're making it. And, I also agree that Piper and Orton needed a win just because Piper and Orton are more over, and JYD didn't, you know.
Were you shocked that Orton pinned JYD? That we didn't get anything with Piper and Snuka?
Yeah, I am. That I am shocked about. I can't believe JYD ate the pin. I am very shocked.
Well, just knowing what next month's main event was, it's not like Piper and Snuka were going to have one more singles match. At least, I mean, maybe down the line we get one, but it seemed like this thing is petering out.
Right.
It was just weird that they both were kept out of the finish.
I would have figured Orton would have been the one that ate the pin, but... the length of that match was 8:45, which
I was
surprised.
A little short for those four guys. I mean, you're going 12 minutes with the anvil and 60, you know, like this to me, it could have been, and I know you want to keep the less is more. It's a wild brawl, but I mean, if this went 12 to 15, these guys could easily have eaten up that much time.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Step one, again, crowd was nuclear because of Piper. I mean, like I said, JR, it's just one. And I'm not knocking the baby faces by any stretch, but back then being a baby face was kind of easy. I mean, just one fantastic heel after another in this promotion right now. Mm-hmm. Morocco's a heat magnet. Studs a heat magnet. I don't know if Patera is, but Bobby certainly is. Piper, Orton are just ridiculous. I mean, just guys who care about their craft are just so amazing in this stretch right now. And this is exactly what Vince needs as we get into the new era. Step two, I wasn't surprised that JYD replaced Tonga Kid. First off, Tonga Kid, I don't know if he was really hurt or not, but
that was drugs, wasn't it?
I think he did get pinched, right? Yeah. I think he did get pinched. But I think it worked out because Tonga was not as experienced, and I think he'd have been fucking lost in this shit show. So I think it was better off for an experienced guy like JYD to be in this match. So I think it was better off anyway. And step three, I mentioned it before the break. Do you remember the iconic moment of this match that I was talking about that's on dozens of WWF home video / Coliseum videotapes?
Why don't you share with us?
The double slam when Piper and Orton double slammed Snuka is on like the beginning montage of every best of the WWF vault.
There you go.
It's that the I think it's Hogan's elbow drop on Johnny Rods with the rare alternate blue tights.
Oh, right, yeah.
I think there's probably a couple of pile drivers in there.
Let me ask you this about Piper. So did he feel coming out of this like a guy prepared for a world title feud?
Hard to tell because you're trying to think to yourself, think of the guys that, because remember, 84 was still strictly house shows. So you think back for a minute, who did Hogan wrestle in 84? Well, he wrestled Sheik, obviously. He feuded with Stud. Him and Stud had a couple of great matches. There's one on the first Hulkamania tape. I think it's a steel cage match from St. Louis that's actually very good. Greg Valentine, he had some good matches with. So you think to yourself, I think Hogan's kind of in a holding pattern right now. So, yeah, I guess I could kind of see Piper as the number one contender as a heel. I think I can. As great as the other heels are on this roster right now, that doesn't necessarily mean where they are in the pecking order of on the card. I think Piper is a guy that could be positioned as a number one contender, definitely.
We'll see how it
particularly
goes.
Winning this match, you know, particularly winning this match. So, fun match. I liked it slightly better than you. I give it 2.5. And it showed that all four guys, I mean, let me ask you this. Were you surprised Snuka didn't get pinned only because of the four guys in the ring? He seemed like Snuka was over, but it seemed like not as much as the other three guys were, you know?
Well, when you look at what they had planned for JYD and Piper specifically, yeah, I thought Piper should have just beaten Snuka here and kind of, and you could have protected Snuka a bit by having Orton clobber him from behind or something. I mean, unless they have another match planned down the line that we're going to get to, we'll see, but it kind of felt like this was it for them, as Kenny Loggins sings. Don't be a fool anymore. So, I mean, it felt like this was probably the end of the road for them. I was a little surprised. I really thought Snuka would have been the one to eat the pin or get the pin to end the feud, maybe pin Orton and keep Piper protected. So, yeah, I was a little shocked that JYD, who was fairly new and being lined up for a guy again that was going to be set up for a title match soon, was the one taking the pin from someone like Orton. So, yeah, the whole thing was pretty surprising to me. And again, it wasn't bad. I just expected it to go a little bit longer and be a little bit more wild. And when you look at the time granted to some of these other matches on the show, for that to only be, was it 8 minutes or whatever? Not even? Felt a little disappointing.
It was, 8:45, I think.
Yeah,
I
something
said.
Like that.
Yeah, 8:45.
Okay. All right, why don't we move along?
This is it. Even here, my friend, we can slide a little yacht rock in there.
Don't be a fool anymore. It was actually probably it fits better in the 85 than the modern day anyway.
That is true.
Michael McDonald's king.
That's right. I mean, on a side note, on a tangent, isn't it now just comical? By the way, Yacht Rock is still a channel on SiriusXM, and if you have it, listen to it all the time. Isn't it now comical that the Michael McDonald actually has a bump on there now?
Oh, yeah, he has to. I mean, he's in every goddamn song. I mean, he's
pretty much. So, all right. Here's a quick spell for the crowd before our big main event, JR. One of the iconic jobbers taking on a guy who's I think he's a TNT mainstay, this fine gentleman.
Oh, well, I don't know which is which, but we have the spoiler taking on Rick McGraw. Spoilers, Canadian wrestler Don Jardine, who began wrestling at the age of 15 in 1955. During his career, Jardine would have success in several NWA territories, including Florida, Georgia, and the WCCW in Texas, world class, of course. While in Texas, he would pass along to a move to a young talent that is still seen today, as he would do the top rope walk, something he'd eventually teach to Mark Calloway, who would become The Undertaker. Spoiler, also part of the original Legion of Doom, along with Jake Roberts, King Kong Bundy, and the Road Warriors. Jardine would pass away in 2006, and he does indeed battle Quick Draw Rick McGraw, started wrestling in Florida. 1976, trained by Rip Hawk, took on the name Quick Draw based on the cartoon character Quick Draw McGraw, had an initial run in the Federation in the late 70s, mainly wrestling heels and building them up in preparation to wrestle Bob Backlund, would last to wrestle, left to wrestle in several NWA territories before coming back as part of the Carolina Connection tag team with Steve Travis. McGraw passed away in November of 85 at the age of 30 after having a heart attack. Bret Hart wrote in his autobiography that McGraw was known to take the drug Placidil, typically prescribed for insomnia. Hart indicates that taking the drug probably contributed to the heart issues of old Quick Draw. I would argue also adding to his heart issues, Scott, were the massive amount of steroids he was using.
Oh my God, yes.
Because he is short and very, very compact. Just muscle on top of muscle, likely on top of thick, filled arteries.
Hanging up all, yes.
Just juice to the gills. So we'll
That was it for Rick McGraw.
Don't be a fool anymore. So, spoiler grabs a side headlock, but Quick Draw turns into a leg lock. Gene talks about McGraw's comeback from a broken back when he was told he'd never wrestle again. McGraw would work the arm for a bit, so Spoiler drills him with some hard elbows to send McGraw to the floor to gain his bearings. Tried to punch his way back into things, but Spoiler maintained control, choking away at the, McGraw and then landing a backbreaker for two. Spoiler blocked a monkey flip and hit a sledge off the top rope. McGraw came back with a shoulder breaker and hit some weird, awkward skull cracker move for a two count. Spoiler popped up and meandered through some more offense, kicking Quick Draw to the floor. Spoiler ambled over the ropes. McGraw yanked him out and slugged away. Spoiler tried to grab a chair, but McGraw smacked it away and pitched him back inside. Spoiler cracked him as he came back in and hit a double underhook suplex for the win. I thought it was a really bad match. Both guys were awkward. They had no flow at all. Spoiler just shook off any offense that McGraw levied in and went back to his basic strikes on a whim. McGraw had some spunk, but not a good showing for either guy. I went full dud here. I thought Spoiler looked awful. Like, he just didn't want to be there. He didn't give a shit about anything that McGraw had going on. Anytime McGraw would hit him, he would just keep chugging along and doing his stupid offense. And then McGraw was a step off with everything. Easily my worst match of the night so far.
You don't even want to know how long the match was.
I mean, it had to be like, what, 16 minutes, something like that?
No. 8:59.
Oh, God.
But it felt like 48:59.
It was bad. It was real bad. I mean, in a night filled with duds, this was the duddiest of all of them.
The formatics of the duddy. Yeah, this match sucked. Besides the fact that the hand, by the way, the spoiler was the TNT guy, because I think he was on TNT in 84 like three fucking times. So,
I mean, we saw him at World Class a couple times too in the network adventure. I mean, maybe at this point, just didn't give a shit. I don't know. But he was not very impressive here.
Well, he was getting checks.
Hopefully, not very, not a lot of zeros involved in those checks.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe after the decimals point. Yeah, the thing about Rick McGraw's neck / back injuries, Gorilla's like fucking slamming the guy. Like, you know, I tell you something, Gene. Ever since he got the injury, I don't think he really cares anymore. I think that fire's gone. I hope the spoiler kills him. It's like so weird. I have to agree with you, Gorilla. Not doing very well. Here at the Garden on this January. Yeah, I know. They really think he sucks now. It's like, so, why don't you just go over there and fucking kill the guy? Go in and re-break his neck if you want. It was just so weird.
Yeah.
So strange. It was like what we'd hear from Gorilla like in 94. You know, it's like so bizarre. And he's just burying the fucking guy. Meanwhile, he's got to wrestle this big lump of shit that didn't want to do anything.
And McGraw's like a guy, too, that we'll see next month as well, where, I mean, size-wise, like bulk-wise fit in, height-wise, just completely overmatched at this time period.
He's definitely what you would call like one of the original vanilla midgets. Right. So there's any doubt about
way too tiny, way too short. looks just like a little, you know, spark plug kind of guy. Just, I mean, you know, looks wise was fine, but in the world of WWF in the mid 80s, just not tall enough to really mean much. And the fact that, I mean, FSI, he's all uncoordinated. Like, a lot of his moves and offense were just, maybe it's more on spoiler. We'll see as we move along, but. I mean, if I looked at him here, I probably just would have fired both these guys after this match. I mean, that's how much I disliked it. And we don't do negative stars here, but this would be in the negatives for me if we went that way.
No, I agree. It wasn't good at all. So let's just move on. All right.
No steps. That's it.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to our – before we get to the main event, JR, two things I want to mention. First off, we go backstage again. Mm-hmm. And who is Mean Gene with?
Arriba, Tito Santana. He says they're lifting the curfew here, so nothing will save the hammer tonight. So, of course, there was always a curfew at some of these arenas where the match would basically be called a draw if they hit a certain, whatever it was, midnight or 11 p.m., you know, whatever.
I think it was 11. I think it was 11 at the Garden. But isn't that one of the little things that, like, you and I always have these conversations about, like, the little nuances of old school, like 80s wrestling and like the curfew. Like, that's one of those cool things that we miss.
The curfew,
you know?
Is fucking stupid, but yes.
No, it is stupid, but it was cool in the sense that.
Right,
like,
they
could
lift it and made it seem like a big deal. I mean, it's one of those things where it's annoying when it exists, but it's super cool when they say no curfews tonight. Like, it makes it seem like such a bigger deal.
Yeah, like, it's like, we'll wrestle all night if we have to, kind of thing. Yeah, it's very neat.
And it was kind of like the Bill Watts mentality in 92 WCW where he would say, like, we're lifting the mats off the ground and banning the top row moves, which seemed real dumb and probably was, but his thought was when they allow it, it would mean more, you know? So that, I think that's the thought process here. Like, everyone hates curfews and time limits, but God, when we have a match without one, especially a big time match like this, it means something.
Correct. I agree 100% on that. Then we find out, Gorilla and Mean Gene are talking, but the Fink comes out, JR, right before our main event and says, that due to the shenanigans of earlier tonight, or some the way Gorilla and Mean Gene were talking over him, next month, JR, at the big show here on February 18th, it will be Rowdy Roddy Piper taking on the World Wrestling Federation Heavyweight Champion, Hulk Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
Hulk Hogan. Next month, February 18th, live here at the Garden. Big deal. Little do we realize, JR, at the time, how big a deal it would be. Obviously, Hogan is not here. Does that bug you?
No.
No?
He didn't,
you know,
to
who's not
it
on this show, which sucks because they were so fucking awesome, was our World Wrestling Federation Tag Team Champions, mm-hmm, Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. Oh, my God, were they awesome.
And yeah,
go ahead.
No, I was going back to the Hogan thing, but finish on that.
Oh, okay. No, I was going to say, I mean, we've been watching the TNTs for the adventure, and, I mean, they were so fucking awesome. They're such total douches. It's so great. The vignettes were Mean Gene would visit each other's places. Like, they, you know, for Adonis, they go, mm-hmm, like, to fucking Queens or the Bronx or whatever, and then they go to Murdoch's ranch in Texas or whatever, and, oh, don't talk too loud. We don't know where he's walking around. They're so awesome. And then really there's the great stuff. TNT. Then there's the great TNT episode where they're heckling fucking Chief J. Strongbow in the street or the fucking parking lot or whatever. They're all dancing in the dark.
They drive in their fucking Buick and harass them.
Oh, so fantastic.
But the Hogan thing doesn't bother me. There's a lot of star power on the show. He didn't need to beat everyone. And it kind of worked out that he wasn't there this time because then they hype up the huge match for next show. So make sure you're here because Hogan's going to be here. I mean, they had plenty of star power between Piper, Andre, Snuka, and then the main event here.
Yeah.
You know, more than enough to sell this show.
Right.
So our main event is Tito Santana versus Greg Valentine, Intercontinental title line, no curfew. And the on-screen announcement, our buddy Jeff Jarvis noted the spelling error of the night, title, T-I-T-A-L. So that was, expect that terrible in the Sutton notes, but not on the, not on the graphics of Madison Square Garden.
I can't believe no one I'm surprised no one at MSG noticed it. Very strange.
So huge matchup of heated rivals, epic feud, Santana Valentine, two of the best. Fink announces, like you said, Hogan Piper for next month. Crowd is fired up here. Gorilla and Gene do a really nice job putting over their history, the storyline, both men taking their time locking up so they can go through everything, really building up the tension. before they lock up. They finally make contact. Tito unleashes an uppercut and then shrugs off a hammer punch to slam the champ and grab a chin lock. The match resets. Both guys have another standoff as Tito screams at Hammer to start throwing down. Tito goes at the knee looking for some payback, and he's able to trip up Hammer and drop knee-to-knee joint on Valentine, sending him scurrying to the floor. Hammer's limping around and slid back in. He was unable to catch Tito and then slams into the mat before going to work on the back with some measured knee drops. Hammer keeps the pressure on the abs and lower back, hitting a gut buster for a pair of two counts. Hammer hooks on a bear hug as the crowd tries to rally Tito, but Hammer rams him hard into the corner before he can break it. Tito tries to make a comeback with a punch to the gut, but Hammer smacks him around and then grabs an abdominal stretch while grinding his fist into the ribs. Tito breaks the hold by grabbing the ankle and flipping Hammer around, but Hammer bounces up and drills the lower back again. And I actually thought Gene was really good in this match. He picks up a lot of little things and calls them before they happen. Like Tito, as soon as he's in that abdominal stretch, he starts to grab for the ankle. And Gene's like, watch that, watch him here. He's grabbing that ankle. He's going to try and flip out of it. And then he does it. So I thought that was really cool and insightful from Gene. Something that we didn't get a ton of, but I thought it was well done. So Tito battles to his feet, but Hammer just wrecks him with a huge forearm to the head in an awesome spot. He follows that up with a backbreaker and an elbow for two, and then went back to the bear hug. Tito forces the break and then starts to land some shots to the gut and a big knee to the head, but Hammer goes to the eyes and drills the lower back. Santana would dodge a charge and causes Valentine to crotch himself on the middle rope, and the crowd is just all revved up now. Tito fires up and starts to punch and knee away before hitting an atomic drop and a huge chop. Tito keeps hammering away, but Hammer slides to the edge of the ring. Tito meets him there and suplexes him back in for a two count. Tito crawls over and targets the knee more, but Hammer breaks free from a figure four attempt and quickly slides outside. Tito chases him again and chucks him right back in the ring, trips him up and went for the figure four again, but Valentine again yanks him to the mat and slides outside. Tito heads back out again, shoves Hammer into the ring apron, and then back inside. He slams him hard, but whiffs on a flying forearm and rolls out to the floor. Tito rolls back inside, but Hammer catches him with a stiff blow to the back of the neck. Hammer lands a shoulder breaker for a near fall and then went to work on the leg. Tito struggles to his feet, and Hammer just viciously slugs away at him until he collapses. Hammer pitches Tito to the floor, but the challenger won't stay there. He claws back onto the apron. Hammer meets him there and lands some elbows and yanks him back inside. Hammer goes to the figure four, but Tito grabs him in an inside cradle for two. Tito kicks free out of another figure four, followed by a double clothesline that took both men out. They both get to their feet, but Tito's the aggressor and pelts Hammer with a flying forearm, sends him to the floor, where he eventually is counted out, giving Tito the win, but not the title. The crowd goes nuts as Tito celebrates with the belt, but the referee reminds him of the rules. We get the official announcement as the show wraps up. I thought the match had awesome psychology and work by both men on both sides of the coin. The comebacks are impeccable. Every time Hammer was in trouble, he killed Tito's momentum with some stiff, rugged blows. Every single thing they did made sense. It was so rough and fluid at the same time. The chemistry of these guys is top-notch. The crowd ate it up completely. I loved how many times they ended up on the floor, because eventually you'd assume it would be a count-out after all the teases, but they never did. And then it does, and it felt organic. Hammer escapes another war, survives with the title. A great match from Tito. And I like that they played up the revenge, because if you remember, like we saw Scott and a lot of the TNTs, Hammer fucked up Tito's knee. So we saw the footage of Tito going to surgery and making his comeback, and Hammer really attacks that knee here, and they really play things up. So I can watch these guys wrestle all day long. Fantastic match, 4 stars for me. I could have went another 15 minutes easily with these guys.
Official time, 2021.
Yeah, and it felt like 3 minutes. I mean, it flew by.
Yeah.
These guys are just awesome.
Right now, I don't think there's a pair, maybe Andre and Bobby, I don't think there's a pair in the company right now that has better chemistry than these two guys. They've been wrestling since August, probably July.
Well, and do you think they're the two best workers in the promotion at this time?
Yeah, it's hard to argue it. Hard not to argue.
I guess it depends what you thought of Bret Hart at this point, but
well, Bret's a kid. Bret's not a Tito or Val.
Yeah, he was still a good worker though. At that point,
he's a great worker. Yes. I don't think
Orton
he's
maybe.
What
Orton?
If who? Ooh, yeah. Let me look at who else is on this card. Anybody else pops up?
McGraw.
Orton. Spoiler. No.
I'd say Bret. Bret and Orton, probably the...
Yeah. Probably Hammer, Bret,
I mean, the top five at the least, but I think even higher than that.
Yeah. This feud is tremendous. and this shows it. And the great best part about it is we're going to get more of it. I continue talking about awesome heels all night. And all for different reasons. But the best heel worker in the company is Greg Valentine right now. I mean, the guy is methodical. I remember the burning joke, which I don't think Hammer, I don't think Gorilla did on this one, but you know he does it later on in the decade of the whole, oh, it takes him 45 minutes to get going. And you see why he says that, because he's just so methodical, and he just bludgeons you. And he may not be like a technician kind of guy, although he does have some pretty expert maneuvers. This is a guy who was a tag team champion and feuded with Flair, so he wasn't. In fact, I noticed in ring, not like, you know, the strut or anything like that, but you even saw a little bit of Flair in Valentine, mm-hmm. in some of his mannerisms. Just knows his shit. And, you know, having a father who was a legendary wrestler doesn't hurt matters either. Like in the case of Brett. Just watching him wrestle was just amazing in this day. He was one of my brother's favorite guys at the time. Because he was just so good at what he did. And he was the perfect guy to help elevate the Intercontinental title into the new era. And I think US Express, who are not on this show, but you know, and the other teams coming up in the coming months will elevate the tag straps as well. But Hammer just got it. You know, here's a guy who wrestled all over the country, but spent time in Crockett, where they know their shit. And he just worked with Tito. And look, I'm not knocking Tito that Tito like had to be carried or anything, not at all. But a babyface is easier to kind of handle comebacks and work the crowd and that kind of thing. But for Hammer to dictate the tempo, and you figure how many times these guys wrestled since probably July, and then of course Hammer won the belt in August, just was so unique and so special, mm-hmm. the way that they worked the match and how he was in being different than Piper. You know, Piper was the bombastic, effervescent heel, whereas Valentine was this quiet, methodical, you know, blunt force object. And that's what I loved about watching Valentine wrestle. Easily the best match of the night. I'll give it 4 stars like you. I wanted to give it 4.5. I didn't want to push it that far. I'll give it 4 stars because I think there may be even better matches between these two on the horizon.
Oh, for sure. And the cool thing with them is they're stiff and fluid at the same time.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
You know, they beat the shit out of each other, but they're so fluid with everything they do.
Yep.
They're just natural adversaries. It's beautiful.
It's crazy, right? I mean, it's crazy. Yeah.
I mean, Tito's such a good fiery underdog, and Hammer's just such a good brute heel. It's just made for each other, these two guys. Both use the figure four. You know, so it's everything about them just mirrors the other. And it's simple. Like, they didn't even need a story. They had a great story, but they didn't need in-depth. I mean, they just go out there, and you could tell. They were so good at telling the story in the ring, the two of them, that you knew exactly. You could just put any of their matches on. You knew exactly what the story was. Like, Tito's knee is fucked up. And he wants his belt back. He's pissed off.
Yep.
Like, that's, I mean, that is the story. And they execute it brilliantly.
Do you really need any more? Yeah, nope. Do you really need any more? No, not at all. Absolutely not.
Great way to finish tonight.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Good. A good main event to have on a show that Hogan's not on.
Did you like the finish?
It was a little confusing. And I'm not a big fan. The only knock on it, it's not the match because it's post-match. I hate when baby faces take the belt. You know you won by count out. Don't be fucking stupid.
Yeah.
You weren't born yesterday.
No, I agree.
I always hate things like
that. It's like they're trying to trick the ref into letting him keep it or something.
I know, yeah. it was just so well done. It was a great main event, and it was a perfect match to end the show, considering we didn't have either the world champion or the tag team champions on this show. So, as a matter of fact, curious. I'm going to go – I only have the MSG here. Before we get to the rest of our stuff, I want to go to, if there was any other shows that night and if those guys were somewhere else, let me just take a quick peek at the history of WWE.com. Where was Hogan? Where was, Murdoch?
I'll tell you where I was, brother. Keeping those blacks out of my store.
MSG, was there another show? Ah, well, the other show that night? The Hartford Civic Center. Here was the card. Jose Luis Rivera fought Charlie Fulton to a draw.
Oh, boy.
David Schultz defeated SD Jones.
I'm glad we're doing MSG and not New Haven cards.
Yeah, Connecticut cards. Well, this is Hartford. Johnny V defeated Salvatore Bellomo. Tony Atlas defeated Brutus Beefcake via disqualification. Paul Orndorff pinned Ivan Putski. WWF World Champion Hulk Hogan pinned Nikolai Volkoff. And Barry Windham and Mike Rotundo. Oh! I guess we should say it now. Because on this night, we had new World Tag Team Champions. Because on this night in Hartford, the U.S. Express actually defeated Murdoch and Adonis.
There you go. I mean, that card is dog shit.
The last two matches. Well,
imagine if they had that match on this card, though.
Holy shit.
Yeah, it would have been big.
Get rid of Sleeper. Get rid of Sleeper. I almost call him the Sleeper instead of the Spoiler. He might as well have been the Sleeper.
Dump that and Goulet in his 15 claw holds. And
put that match? Holy shit. The guard would have melted. Wow. So on this night, about 2 hours north of here. And so there you go, Sutton. I'm giving you a prelude to the next set of notes.
Good notes.
There you go. The U.S. Express on this same night, JR, became the World Tag Team Champions.
All right. Very good. Very good. All right. So I want to wrap things up here. So we are going to do some awards, and we'll go through them one by one. Mm-hmm. Let's go with the final overall grade of the show, Scott. Out of 10, like we do with the adventure. I went 4.5 out of 10.
I'm going to say 5.5 out of 10.
Okay.
I liked the main event was fantastic. I liked Hogan. I mean, I liked Andre and Patera, and I just felt a good energy in the show. And I actually liked the tornado match a little bit more than you did. So that's probably where our half point differs, because I really like the tornado match. So I'm going to give it 5.5.
Okay. So 4.5 from me. All right. So first up, we're going to go with the match of the night, which I think is pretty easy in this evening here. I'm going with Tito Valentine, 4 stars.
Oh, there's no doubt. I concur. Okay. Great main event. Unbelievable. Honorable mention to Andre and Patera.
So we had a basket full of duds on the show, but I thought that, like I said, the duddiest of all of them was McGraw versus Spoiler, which was just fucking terrible.
Oh, it was awful. So that was absolutely terrible.
That's my worst match of the night.
Me too. Me too.
My MVP, Scott, was actually Greg Valentine. I wanted to maybe give it to both guys, but I thought Valentine was the one that, like you said, really dictated the pacing of the match. And he was the aggressor going after the knee. I thought he was smart with the way he worked the final moments of that match and eventually got himself counted out, basically. He was my best guy of the night.
I'm going to disagree, as well, even though I just gave flowering praise to Greg Valentine. To me, I'll give him number 2 on the night. I'm going to give it to Andre.
Hmm.
I mean, he put that match over, and he beat the shit out of Bobby. He's smacking, he's paintbrushing him, he's beating the shit out of him, he's chucking Patera all over the fucking place. He's butt-splashing everybody. I mean, for a guy whose body was probably at this point just starting to break down, Andre was a, you know, to quote, you know, to use his nickname, he was the boss during that match. And I think he continued. I mean, he got the moment. He put over Patera and Bobby, and continued to put the feud over. So in the, I think best. Well, we'll get to another. I think the best worker of the night, or the guy who was the best individual wrestler of the night, to me was Valentine. But the MVP in terms of everything, the complete package, I got to give it to Andre.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Worst worker. And I do think we should name the award after him going forward, and that is the Spoiler.
The Spoiler Award!
So I think it is the Spoiler Award going forward. The Spoiler gets my choice tonight, because he looked like he wanted to be anywhere, anywhere outside of, you know, MSG at this point.
Right.
So I'm renaming it right now.
Yeah, it is the Spoiler Award, and
you
he gets
the Spoiler
it.
Getting this? Okay.
Yes, I did get it.
It was fucking terrible.
Oh, he was a disaster. Second place to this. I hate to do this, but we'll give an honorable mention to the Sweeter. Come on, Sweeter. Step it up.
Yeah,
step it up,
highlight.
Sweeter.
Not
all right.
Highlight. So, all right. So next up we have the, we call it the Juice Award for now. We'll have to see whoever wins the first few, we'll kind of rename it after them. So this is really just, and I think it's fitting, because we're going to be in the 80s for a while in the WWF. And I mean, the juiced up, roid up guys don't really vanish until the, you know, mid 90s. So I think we have a lot of years and a lot of shows to make this a worthy award. So my choice tonight was Rick McGraw. And knowing that he died of a heart attack 8 months later or whatever, makes me much more comfortable 11th. As well in my selection, because I think he really was the most juiced. Not a ton of gas on this show. I thought Terry Gibbs was pretty jacked up. I'm guessing Neidhart was probably on something just based on the build he had going on. Yeah. Even
case
the Moondogs.
Case of Labatt Blue.
Yeah, so I mean, Patera, I'm sure, was juicing. Snuka. But I'll go with McGraw. I thought he was packing the most muscle onto the most compact frame.
Yeah, he was rather puffy. I have to. Him and Terry Gibbs looked a lot alike. Yeah. On that show,
racist.
So maybe a honorable mention to Terry Gibbs, but I'll go with a quick draw with you.
I don't think he was juiced enough though to name the award after him just yet.
No, we got to have a few shows in, I think, before we don a name for it, because don't forget Ted Arcidi's coming.
Yeah. And Don Morocco still has to go to the pharmacy.
That's yeah, still got to go to Billy Graham's house.
And we got Hogan coming up too, so we got a lot. Yeah, to
exactly.
All right. Best moment of the night to me was Andre beating the shit out of Patera and Heenan to close out their match.
Yep, I agree. Okay, because like I said, that was best moment of the night. MVP worker of the night. Yeah, that whole segment was tremendous. Got the crowd so red hot. I think helped him with the tornado match towards the end, and definitely helped set up the main event. So I agree with you with Andre on that one.
All right, and that'll do it. So we are wrapping things up. Scott, I enjoyed this.
It was awesome.
Cool to talk about some different guys, mix things up a bit. Hopefully everyone else enjoyed it, and bear with us. You know, we're still working out the kinks of the formatting here, so I'm sure we'll get more comfortable as we go on week by week, but stick with us if you have any feedback or thoughts. And also, if you want to share your choices for all the awards, I know our buddy Steven Sutton has some, and those listening, go to the Facebook page, either the Facebook PlayStation Nation page or the live chats page, and share your votes for who you think would be the winners of those categories after you watch the show, which is available on YouTube as well. So if you want to check it out there, feel free to join in, listen along, and then share your thoughts on the card, your feedback, as well as your award winners, and we'll converse on the Facebook page.
Yep.
All right, Scott, PlayStation.com, lots going on, of course. You can follow us on all of the social media avenues. You can, of course, check out all of our feeds on iTunes, the PlayStation Nation Wrestling feed, the PlayStation Nation Pop feed, the Pro Wrestling Only feed, and the Kevin Kelly Show feed. So check out the four of those. Subscribe now today. And be sure to leave us ratings as well. Check out all of our regular features and podcasts that are upcoming week over week. Our network adventure, which we're going to reference quite a bit throughout these shows, as well as all of our other weekly installments, Seinfeld, and our Vintage Roll refreshes, the ebooks that are available via the right hand of the site. And, of course, with Cyber Monday having been today and the Christmas season and shopping season firing up, be sure to use our link, PlayStation.com/Amazon, before you go online shopping. Get a little bit of kickback here. Keep the site up and running. So easy one stop for you. Just type that in, and then you can do all your shopping as normal. Don't need to do anything else. So there you go. Anything else you have before we wrap things up?
No.
Main event this week?
Not at all. But our next show, of course, is a big one. And
is there a main event this week?
There is a main event this week. Okay. It is, of course, the preview of TLC on Sunday. And I can tell you that our guests will be Mr. Jason Greenhouse and, making a return, my Campus Hot Takes compadre, Mr. Logan Crosland, will be joining us this week, and we'll preview TLC.
All right. Very good. All right. So that's it. We'll be back next week with a very big show. That is a war to settle a score, Scott. So that is February
18th,
1985 from MSG. Of course, partially, or at least a sliver of it, was aired on MTV, which we'll talk all about that. And then after that, we got one more house show, and then we'll get to Mania by the end of December. So it'll be a fun trek. I'm really looking forward to the war to settle the score, and I really enjoyed the show tonight. So hopefully everyone else out there did as well.
Yes.
Like I said, leave your feedback, leave your thoughts on the show, as well as the reboot here. I think that's it, though. So for Scott, I'm Justin. We're out. We'll talk to you next Monday. We'll be settling some scores via a war.
Goulet. Rene Goulet will not get Samson. And this is a beat they can't touch. Yo, I told you, you can't touch this. Why you standing there, man? You can't touch this. Yo, sound the bell, school is in, sucker. You can't touch this. Give me a song, a rhythm, making them sweat. That's what I'm giving them now. They know, you're talking about the hammer, you're talking about a show that's hot and tight. Singles are sweating so fast, I'm a whiteboard tape. To learn, what's it gonna take in the 90s to run the charts? Legit, either work.
touch this. You can't touch this. Break it down. Touch this. You better get a hype, boy, because you know you can't touch this. Ring the bell, school's back in. Break it down. Stop. Have a time. You can't touch this. Break it down.